Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Today in Trial OJ, lawyers argued over whether the former Heisman winner is an arthritic cripple incapable of murder.
He has bad knees, arthritis, and limited mobility. He may look like Tarzan, but he moves like Tarzan's grandfather.
After that, the jury got a peek at an exercise video Simpson taped just 2 weeks before the murder.
Break it all the way down. Feel it in your knee. Yeah. Love that intensity. And if you're working out...
Hello?
Is this Laura Hart McKinney?
Yes. How may I help you?
The Laura Hart McKinney who used to live in Los Angeles, who has tapes of LAPD officer Mark Furman.
How did you find me?
I'm an investigator working for O.J. Simpson. We believe our client is innocent, and your tapes could really help him.
Well, I don't want to help him.
Look, I was just writing a screenplay about the LAPD. I met Mark,
and I interviewed him for research.
So there are tapes. What does he say? How inflammatory is it?
I never asked to be a part of this.
Is it true?
Yeah. Tapes exist. I think they're really ugly. They have phrases like, stuff like, get niggers, fram niggers. Plant evidence.
Jesus Christ, can we confirm the authenticity?
I've asked around. Her lawyers have shot the tapes to London papers, TV tabloids. They've heard snippets. Supposedly there's an offer on the table for $250,000.
Why didn't she sell?
Well, that's the strange part. She doesn't actually care about the money. She'd rather sell her screenplay. She's a screenwriter. Or, well, a wannabe screenwriter. She was living in L.A., she couldn't make a living, so she moved to North Carolina to teach screenwriting.
I don't understand. How can you teach screenwriting if you can't sell a script?
Gentlemen, you are missing the point. I don't care who she is or what she does. What matters are these tapes. We must get them. Get niggas? Frame niggas? That takes my breath away. These tapes will allow Mr. Simpson to walk free.
Well, let's not get too cocky. I mean, we haven't heard them. Look, lucky breaks don't just fall from the sky.
Yes, they do, Mr. Check. God brought us these tapes. There's something much larger at play here. This is manna from heaven.
The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, January 12, 2021. So I have been told, before we get started, I think one of our listeners, brand new mom, first offspring, just had a so-called birthday. Not that, you know, I'm into celebrating birthdays, but if you are going to do one, I guess your first offspring's first so-called birthday, that might be one to bend the rule for. Hope everybody was safe. Have a good time. Next, certainly, since we're getting two OJ days this week, have to remind people our book club. We are at the halfway point of Jeffrey Toobin's The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. We are getting to the good stuff, starting the trial, all of the buildup and jury selection and everything else, getting to the trial. I'm so excited. And it's like we got a supplement. We'll get extra information to help us as we move through the book. It has been a hoot, especially for folks. A lot of people saying that either they were really young, and so they were either a child or not born when the trial happened, or they remember where they were, what they were doing, and, you know, how their views have changed and such since the trial. So it has been fun for lots of reasons. And whew, the fun is about to increase exponentially with the trial beginning, the book club on Thursday. We should be here every day. In fact, for about the next week, we'll be here tomorrow. We'll go over the details, but just to stay tuned, we should be on our counter-racist grind for a good week as we begin the new year. 12 years on the air. Invest if you think the program is constructive, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. With that, the audio that you heard at the top, that is from the FX series, extraordinarily popular, won all kinds of Emmys and such. The Run of His Life, based on Jeffrey Toobin's book. He was a consultant for that project, and he is depicted in the middle of the show or what have you series. We heard from Building to the Climax, the scene where they discover the Mark Berman tapes, infamous, the former LAPD detective who claimed that he found the bloody glove on Mr. Simpson's Rockingham estate, scaled the wall, all of the, you know, really key points in the case, and had been asked by F. Lee Bailey, who was a guest on our program just a few weeks back, had been asked previously on the stand, do you call black people niggers? Have you ever called black people niggers? And all the rest of it. And he staunchly, absolutely not. No, I don't. All the rest of it. And then whammo, months later, the tapes are found. And even we'll ask with our guest today, were the tapes even needed? Did O.J. Simpson need these tapes, the so-called manna from heaven? Did he need them to walk, or... we'll see. Our guest for today's broadcast, a private investigator for many years. He's worked on a number of really famous cases, but I think I could be wrong, but I think O.J. Simpson still takes the cake as the case he is most well known for being associated with and I believe credited with being the one who tracked down the leads and information to get the Mark Furman audio recordings. Real hoot to have him with us on the broadcast today. Joining us live, Mr. Patrick J. McKenna. Mr. McKenna, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Tuesday evening. So glad we could have you on the broadcast with us. Before we hop into the details, we have so many questions to go over with the Simpson case. Anything that you'd like to share with our listeners just to kind of give a brief introduction, who you are and the work that you're doing?
Well, sure. Like you said, my name's Pat McKenna. I've been a private investigator since about January of 1981. Excuse me. Mostly criminal defense. I started out in the public defender's office, and prior to that, I was a parole officer in Chicago, where I'm from. Moved to Florida in '78. And so basically for the last, whatever it is now, I don't do the math well, but 30 some odd years, I've been doing mostly criminal defense. And I got involved in this case because I got a call, I want to say the 15th of June, 94, from F. Lee Bailey's partner, Ken Fishman. He called me, said, hey, we might be getting in this Simpson case. Now, this is, what, 2 days later, 3 days later. And he said, if we get it, can you go to Chicago? I said, oh, my hometown, sure. And so that's how it got started. And then he said, well, you'll get a call from Shapiro's office in an hour or two. I just want to make sure you're available. Well, before I got that call, I went and got airline tickets and everything lined up to get out of town the same day and get to Chicago. So that's how I got started. I guess that's June 15th, and I was in Chicago that afternoon, and I had gone directly to the O'Hare Plaza Hotel, which is where Simpson stayed that one night. And so I got set up there. And, you know, took off from there. I spent about, I want to say till early July, I think July 3rd, from the 15th to the 3rd in Chicago. It took me quite a while to get to talking to people because it was so insane with media and everything there. I mean, Clinton was in town. It was the World Cup, first time in America. And then, obviously, the Simpson thing at this hotel, it's hard to even describe. I mean, there were TV trucks as far as you could see. So I kind of just went in there and didn't you know, I just checked in. Nobody knew who I was, and I tried to, and I thought I'd keep it that way. You know, it's much better to do it that way. Keep your ear to the ground, see what you can hear. So that's basically in the, and frankly, to tell you the truth, by the 15th, all I know on TV, I think Simpson did it. All I've heard is what you, if your listeners are old enough, back then, all you heard on TV were the titans of the industry, Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, every night, every all day long. NBC has learned from sources Simpson's a suspect, and the and as days started to go along, he's the only suspect according to law enforcement. There's blood in his washing machine, ski mask, everything. So when I got the call, I thought he probably had done it, but that doesn't deter when in this work, you know.
Can I just get a question in really quick? I think that's so important. What you just shared, number one, you thought he was guilty at the time, still taking the case, but you thought he was guilty. And the press, the media at the time, the major thrust of the reporting, OJ did it. No presumption of innocence, no even presumption of there might be another suspect. Maybe we should be checking some other leads. No, he did it. He did it by himself. OJ and I think that's important because he was such a big star. Like they have, or I guess I'll ask it this way. So many in the book that we're reading, Jeffrey Toobin and so many other accounts, it is O.J. Simpson got star treatment. He was in movies and a big Hall of Famer. And so he got so much more sympathy than he would have got if he had just been a regular olden Samson, not some famous guy. So did you see his celebrity spare him and how the media covered him in that first week or so?
Actually, it crushed him. I mean, the media, they eat their own. I mean, this guy, you know, I should couch my language instead of saying I thought he was guilty. I thought he maybe had done this. Guilty of what yet? So it wasn't a whodunit. It was a what happened. But I thought that he had probably done this just from what I learned from television, radio. I'm talking about at that time, that had to be probably the biggest media event in history, really, in terms of criminal cases. And so, you know, I get to Chicago and I still have this notion that perhaps, you know, there's trouble here for us or, you know, for the client. And so I, you know, started to look for perhaps, and the good thing about thinking he might have done it, it helped me. And questions that I had were, hoping that maybe if there's a self-defense. I had now heard about the second person being killed. There was two people. So I'm thinking, geez, maybe there's, who knows? Was there self-defense? Did he get attacked? I don't know. So most everybody I talked to there, when I finally got to talk to him, and it took a while because you had to get permission, for example, from the lawyers that represent the O'Hare Plaza, the lawyers that represent Hertz, the lawyers that represent American Airlines, because these were the areas I wanted to go and find. I wanted to be like a video camera from the moment Simpson got off the airline until he got back on the airline. So I tried to track and trace and follow up on everything he may have done or where he had been, et cetera. So each person that I would interview that interacted with Mr. Simpson, I would always ask about cuts, bruises. Did you see any, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking I got to start setting something up. Do we have a self-defense? What do we have? So in the end, it really worked out great because those kind of details I went over with everybody and there was no cuts, no bruises, no cut finger, for example, until after he was leaving. And another thing that happened, fortunately for me, was when I got to Chicago, a guy I grew up with, still a dear friend of mine. When I called him, I said, hey, I'm coming in there. Don't tell anybody. And he said, and I asked if he could help me. He said, yeah, sure. He said, as a matter of fact, my, not racquetball, he played handball, Bobby, my buddy. He says, my handball partner and now a client of mine is a guy named Charlie Smith. He's the head of Area 5 detectives. Maybe I could set up a meeting. So I did get a meeting before I could talk to people because, like I said, I couldn't get through to anybody because of lawyers. And so corporate lawyers, you know, telling everybody not to talk to anybody until they cleared, you know, who I was and I'm really who I say I was. And I had a letter from Shapiro and introduced myself to the Chicago cops that were on the scene. And anyway, the Chicago cop I met the second day I was there, Charlie, he wouldn't tell me a whole lot other than they were very upset with the L.A. Police Department. And the reason why is because they treated it, when they got a call, like a crime scene. They went to the hotel, blocked it down, treated everything, interviewed all the people they could interview, and then sent the reports to the LAPD without redacting names and addresses, right? They think, hey, we're all on the same team here. Here's Caroline Goburn. She's the front desk. Here's where she lives. Here's her phone number. Well, when you know LAPD leaked all of this stuff directly to the media with the addresses and phone numbers, and now these folks have got camera crews and everything on their doors at their homes, so everybody is kind of freaked out. So it was very difficult for me to arrange these interviews. But Charlie told me that, you know, they were kind of upset with LAPD because they're treating it very professionally. And LAPD, number one, they're in Chicago, two guys, Detective Looper and Detective LaFall, and they're holding press conferences in the hotel. And I remember I used to go over there with my, they didn't know who I was, with my, and stand amongst the reporters and just listen to what they were saying, try to learn what the cops were saying. They're saying, oh, we take the murder weapons here and all sorts of stuff. So, frankly, I just did my work. I talked to as many people at the Plaza Hotel, the O'Hare Plaza. Then I spoke with the Hertz rental car people. And then I spoke with American Airlines people. All my interviews that I conducted were sat in by the corporate people. So, in other words, the corporate investigators for American Airlines were ex-FBI agents. The corporate investigator from Hertz was a homicide detective out of Detroit, retired, well, now working for Hertz. The O'Hare Plaza guys, I forget who those guys were. Same thing, I think it was FBI or cops. So anyway, they'd sit in, which is very unusual. I don't usually let police officers sit in or even ex-police officers sit in on interviews, but I didn't have a choice. So, you know, we'd sit there and interview, and then even once in a while they'd ask a question. Was his hand sweaty? And they'd butt in, you know. And they were like, actually, they helped, you know, because they were asking questions I might have forgot about. Where was his hand sweaty when he shook your hand? So it turns out after each interview, we'd look at each other and go, man, that don't sound like a guy just committed a double murder. So I went from thinking, yeah, this is the guy, to leaving there 2 weeks later going, Jesus, this doesn't sound like a guy that just killed two people. It's not that he's cool, calm, and collected. He just didn't do things that I think someone that just committed a double murder would have done. Forget it's OJ. But in that it is OJ, I would think he would call back to quote his daughter, like Arnell, and say, hey, how was the movie tonight? Just to look over his shoulder, see how close are the cops to catching me. His demeanor was such that it just, he'd have to be a cold-blooded assassin for the mafia to pull this off and act this way. You know, his demeanor was just one of an innocent person. And then, like I said, I started to find out about the cut finger, and which he cut in Chicago when he broke a glass in the sink when he got the call that his wife had been murdered, or not murdered, killed. His wife had been killed. He starts, what, Nicole? He's freaking out. And he broke this glass. Well, fortunately for me, I end up finding, this isn't while I'm in Chicago, this was a little later, I found a woman named Lori Menzioni who was on the phone with OJ, because when he got this message from, I think it was Detective Phillips, the first thing he did was get on the phone with his secretary, Kathy Randa, back in L.A. Kathy, something's happened, get me back home, blah, blah, blah. You know, because Kathy did all this travel arrangements and such. So she got on the phone with American Airlines, basically didn't hang up and get a new. They're all on this initial phone call, OJ to Kathy. She calls in to American Airlines to connect OJ. American Airlines connects it to, I think it was called Cook's Travel, for emergency travel, and that's how this Lori Menzioni got the call. And so she's taking notes. You know how they take notes, like if you on a computer. So she's got her little notes going on. She didn't know who O.J. Simpson was. And she hears the crash, what happened. Oh, I cut my finger. Oh, my God. And O.J.'s, you know, crying and freaking out. And so that helped later on. Of course, the state fought, or the government, the prosecution in L.A. fought hard to keep her out. And Ito kept her out because he claimed that phone call was not foundational. It's a legal thing, but because they had no record that OJ's on the phone with Cook's Travel because of the way it had been, I don't know what you call that, call forwarded or bring in somebody. So he kept it out, even though it was very, very important, really, to get to the truth, right? Because they got this whole story that OJ did it, cut his finger, he's walking along these footprints, dropping blood from his finger, which later on, you know, we pretty much didn't destroy the blood evidence, but were able to illustrate that the collection of the DNA and the blood and all that was very careless. Okay, it's not. We never fought the science. We had Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, who I've worked with before that case, and I'm still work with them on Innocence Project cases, who knew it, DNA better than anybody, and they basically were able to illustrate that it was a culture of carelessness by the LA crime lab, you know, and these people didn't really have the sophistication that we have nowadays. It's much better. And so we just brought it out, excuse me. And the media covered it like we're all a bunch of, liars. We think the cops conspired to frame an innocent man. We never said any of that. We're just doing what we do in criminal defense. You're trying to get to what the truth is. And so I left Chicago and came back to write my report. And my secretary at the time was my ex-wife now. But so I get home and I'm dictating my report to Shapiro. I don't know, I did 15, 18 pages of all the interviews. Never say anything to her. She turns around. She's done work for me for 30 years. And she turns around and says, wow, this doesn't sound like, what do you think? This doesn't sound, what do you think? I said, I don't know yet. It doesn't sound like a guy who killed two people. She thought the same thing. I send the reports out. Lee gets
Can we pause right there just really quick?
Well, yeah.
You and your wife are thinking, this doesn't sound like a guilty person. I just want to go back to get details just on Chicago before we push forward. I think it's so important. Two points. Number one, you mentioned President Clinton was in Chicago at the time. The World Cup was taking place summer of 94 in Chicago. So you have extraordinary police and enforcement officer presence in Chicago at the time.
Yeah.
And even for this knife search, when the initial reports come out that, hey, O.J. Simpson probably did this, and we think maybe what happened is that he took the incriminating evidence, the knife, bloody clothes, whatever else, ski mask, he loaded all this up in his luggage, he took it to Chicago and disposed of it someplace there, maybe out in the field across from the airport or at the Chicago airport, something like that. That was the narrative.
Yep.
So just if you can talk about the amount of involvement in Chicago for this search. Like you said, LAPD is there. Chicago police is involved. Secret Service, I think. Yeah. The Boy Scouts. Like, just can you talk about the security presence in Chicago?
And frankly, I'm by myself, you know. I'm a sole practitioner doing my thing, walking around, and I'm hearing this stuff, and I'm kind of reacting to it. I don't know. So I hear, the story. I mean, these stories were getting outrageous about a guy seeing I saw a 6'2" black man go running into the field. So being a being that I had worked with F. Lee Bailey for a number of years before this, it's a man that wants every detail you can think of. So in my head, I'm going, wait a minute, he would have had to, if he left and go in this field. So now I go to his room. I try to see how you can get out. The only way to get out of there without being seen, for example, to do this dirty deed, like hide this stuff, and not go through the lobby where you'd be seen by some people, would be to go down the stairway. Oh, for Lee, I counted every, I forget how many stairs there were. So you'd have to go, first of all, you'd have to be smart enough or know that you go down the stairs, and when you go out the garage, wherever to go to this field, the door would lock behind you. So you'd have to have presence of mind to keep the door open so you could sneak back in and run back up 90 stairs, whatever many stairs. So as I'm going through all this, one of the interviews I did was a front desk girl, and she said, oh, you should talk to, Jesus, name escapes me now, but he was the maintenance guy, the supervisor of maintenance for the hotel. He had an original rookie card that he wanted Simpson to sign. Of course, he works in days. Simpson got in at 3 or 4 in the morning. So he left with her. OJ signs this card. So then I want to see the card. I track this guy down. I'm talking to him. He says, by the way, so we're talking. I said, how could a guy get out of here? And back in those days, it was the beginning of, if you recall, for a hotel, you didn't have a key anymore. You had like a credit card that you swiped to open the door, you know? And so what, back then, I didn't know this, and this guy's telling me, he says, well, listen, there's a little computer chip or something in the door that will print out everything every time you entered or exited the door. And that was a protection against if someone came down and said, hey, somebody stole $1 million worth of my jewelry, they could look and see who came in, or not who, but the times the doors were opened and closed, if they could catch a maid or something like that. So anyway, I learn, he gets me this stuff. It was a company outside of Chicago, and I get the whole report that this door was opened when OJ went in it and was closed and never opened again until he left to go downstairs and leave in the morning. So there was no, to me, you know, I'm running all around like a chicken with my head cut off. I said, well, that I can debunk this crap because he never left his room. Right. Unless he climbed out a window from, I think it was on the 9th floor, room 916 or 914. I forget his room. So I kind of knocked that out. So I spent a lot of time thinking, geez, this is crazy. The TV is, they're going nuts. And meanwhile, in my hand, I've got these interviews thinking, wow, this doesn't sound like, you know, somebody just killed two people. And now I find that the people from Hertz that picked him up, these two kids, were the guy who picked him up the night before, threw Simpson's clubs and bags, other than his bag he was going to go to the hotel room, in the trunk of his car and left it there because he's going to pick OJ up at 6 in the morning to take him to the golf course for a function for Hertz. So all the crap on TV about OJ hid this stuff in his bag and blah, blah, blah. Well, that couldn't have happened because the guy, Jim Merrick, who had it in his trunk, got back to the hotel that morning, not in time. OJ had already gone to the airport with a different Hertz guy who now sees the cut finger and the emotion of OJ and all that stuff. So we're able to show that was nonsense. So I did a whole timeline of the bags, the golf bags, and all that sort of stuff. Plus, if you think about this logically, you kill two people, you're going to take all the murder weapons and everything and put them in your luggage. What if your luggage gets dropped off in Memphis, or you know how many people have lost luggage over the years? So
metal detectors.
Yeah, I mean, so that stuff to me, there was so much in this case that I would not laugh at, but go, geez, this doesn't, I mean, can we make sense out of this? That doesn't mean, what you're saying doesn't make sense. So I was fighting both the narrative and the media, but the prosecution's going with all this stuff too, I'm thinking. So I'm trying to debunk every kind of thing I'm seeing out there because, frankly, I'm not talking to anybody. I haven't talked to OJ, haven't talked to Shapiro, none of the lawyers, because it is insane, you know? You can't even get into Shapiro's office because the phones were always busy, so I had no way to communicate. So I'm just doing my thing in Chicago, do my whole thing and come back, to Florida where I live and send the stuff, send my reports out there. And sit, basically, I figured I'm done. You know, they probably got investigators in L.A. and all that sort of stuff to pick it up. So I did my little job. And then, you know, I'm watching the preliminary hearing, and Furman comes on. And I remember calling Lee and saying, man, this, you know, I've seen a million, trust me, and ask any public defender anywhere in the country. You know when the cops are tending to be lying. And you also know when they're lying and they look at you with that look like, yeah, I'm lying, but you can't catch me lying. I hate to say that all cops do this, but if you practice criminal defense and if you're in public defender offices around the country, you've seen it a million times. So I call Lee and say, man, something stinks about this guy.
What specifically stood out from the preliminary hearing about Mark Furman?
Yeah, I said, look how, you know, he's kind of like typical, you know, this handsome Marine, ex-Marine. He's sitting there with a pointer on a chart there, and he's, well, the light cascaded down the cobblestone walkway from the east to the west, and he's all going on and on and on. And I just remember when I think Jerry Ullman was cross-examining him at the time, and when he started to talk about the gloves, Furman would rub under his nose, and we did it. We showed all this in closing argument. You know, we cut all the different pieces from the prelim and put them in there, and you know, it's just something in our world that you notice. You know, something's not right about this guy. You know, and of course, then they had the whole story about the knife. I don't know if your listeners remember this, but there was a place called Ross Cutlery that when OJ was doing a movie or a commercial or something downtown LA, I guess you have a lot of free time in between, you know, cut. And I mean, your folks out there, there's probably people in that business that know what I'm talking about, but he, during a break, just walking around looking to kill time, and he bought this knife as, I guess, a gift. He bought a lot of stuff over the years that were gifts and had it home in his house. And they started hearing about this knife from Ross Cutlery. It's a big, big thing in the prelim, remember? I don't know if you remember, but
yes, sir.
Oh, the prosecution's making a big thing about this knife, and Van Adder took a whole tray down to the medical examiner, Dr. Golden, who we already heard said that he thought there were two different knife wounds, which to us, there's two different people. There's more than one killer. But Van Adder took a whole tray of from Ross Cutlery to the ME to say any of these look like. So they're all thinking they got the knife now. Simpson bought a knife. He only paid cash, $100 cash, blah, blah, blah. No receipts. Well, that's not OJ's fault. That's probably the guy at the Ross Cutlery probably folded that $100 and put it in his pocket. But you know, never paid tax on it. But you remember they abandoned that whole thing because OJ's sitting there telling the lawyers, Jesus, I think that knife is probably in my home. I can only imagine what's going through OJ's head at this time. He's going, Jesus, I got nothing to do with this in there. This is sounding quite nefarious, you know. The limo guy says he sees me running up the driveway and all this stuff. I was still in Florida. They sent out a special master, and they found the knife in OJ's home, examined it with a microscope, and they put it in a brown envelope. And if you remember, that judge held up the envelope at the end of the hearing. Well, then obviously the prosecution was smart enough to say, uh-oh, that must be the knife in that envelope. What could possibly be in this secret envelope? So they abandoned. You never heard about Ross Cutlery and that knife or anything later. But boy, in the preliminary, it sure looked bad. And they made a big thing about that. So they did that with so many things that as the trial went on, we pretty much, I thought, debunked all of that crap. But I ended up talking to Lee, and he said, you need to come out here. They're not really investigating the defense, that is. They only had one guy out there, and he said, they're not knocking on doors and anything. And this is what I do for a living. I hit the streets, and it's old-fashioned knock on doors, who saw, who heard, what, you know? Mm-hmm. Try to figure out what happened. That's how we then built the timeline from that evening, which became our defense. timeline and demeanor. He didn't have time. He didn't have the demeanor of a killer. And then we have Mark Furman, which, you know, that was just the beginning. You know, when I got out there, they said, well, I think Jeff Toobin is the guy that unearthed that lawsuit where Furman was suing for his pension. I wasn't even out there yet. So by the time I get out there, this whole article in the New Yorker is out about maybe he planted the glove. Of course, the rest of the world, the media says, these slimy defense people are going to blame this poor detective for planting evidence. They're just making it up. Well, it turns out we didn't make up anything. I started. They said, we got to go after. In our terms, I think we got to go after the cops. And I remember we're in Shapiro's conference room, and the other investigators were ex-cops, and the one guy says, well, I don't go after cops. I raised my hand. I said, well, I do. I'll take the cops as part of my new job was knocking on doors, doing the timeline. I said, I'll take the cops, too. I'll look into their backgrounds. And so that's, you know, I had Furman, and I had not a whole lot came from Van Adder. Tom Lang was clean as a whistle. Phillips, too, I think. But Furman had a history. So I kind of honed in on this guy, and amongst other things I was doing out there. So that's how the tapes came about. But before that ever happened,
with Mark Furman, because you said you go out to L.A. and you do some knocking on doors, I think Rosa Lopez is important with the whole Mark Furman and his story. Now, I know for listeners and everything, we haven't got to Rosa Lopez in the trial yet, but she was someone who was greatly ridiculed in the trial. And, oh, man, the sleazy defense team, they coached this witness and just got her to make up some testimony that she saw the Bronco and what have you. Can you talk about the importance of Rosa Lopez and even what she says about maybe even hearing Mark Furman?
Yes. So when we get to Rosa, now, Rosa had been interviewed by Shapiro's detective, Pavlik. And that wasn't one of my things. You know, Rosa wasn't mine. We kind of whack up witnesses. I'm over on Bundy developing a timeline. I'm talking to everybody that lived on Bundy. So when the Rosa thing happens, what they did to this poor woman was unbelievable, the way they trashed her. And she's just a sweet little person. And before they did that, though, it became a little bit of a stink because Rosa had said something, I think, to a relative about that's not what happened, because now Shapiro and those guys are saying that Rosa Lopez saw the Bronco at 10:15 because, if you recall, in the prelim and then the trial, the government's timeline is that Simpson committed these murders at 10:15 because they got a problem with the clock. He's got to have plenty of time because he's getting into a limo at 10:55 that night, clean as a whistle, getting ready to travel, cool, calm, and collected. So now they figure we only got a half hour, half hour to figure all this out. They haven't found anything yet, blood, clothes, knives, any of that. So I spent a bunch of times with Rosa, and so I'd go to her house. She lived in the same house next door to OJ with the Salingers, I think was the name of the family that lived next door. So I would go and sit with Rosa and go over this with her, and she was so distraught over the crap she was getting by her own family, and they were just, painting her as this horrific liar that the defense had set up. So I'd sit and say, well, tell me what happened. And she remembered, like every night I'd make myself a cup of tea and I took the dog out to piddle. And that was about it. So I go through everything with her. Show me. And so she's got a little stove. And I see she doesn't do the stove. She puts a cup of water in the microwave, about a minute and 30 to heat the water up. At the same time, she's putting a collar around the dog. You know how you put those collars on dogs when they scratch themselves? So this dog had to have this collar over that little white plastic, hood or something. She's doing that while the thing is cooking. Well, Pavlik had talked her to say, well, it took 5 minutes to make a cup of tea, then 5 minutes to put the collar on, then 5 minutes to go outside. This whole process took a minute and a half. So as I'm going through, I said, well, so this is what happened. So now I'm thinking, you know, we got a problem now here. This would have been just a decent witness to throw into the mix. She saw the Bronco at 10 at night and saw it again the next morning, and it didn't look like it had moved. That's all. That's all she was. I shouldn't say that's all, but that is kind of important. Now, you can argue and say, well, he could have. She could have seen it at 10. He could have taken off and got there 10, got back the next morning. You could have, if you're the government, you could have tried to move it that way. Now they paint her as this horrific liar and try to destroy her. What I found from talking to her at length, I learned something even more important. That early in the morning, meaning between 1 and 5, she heard what she called hard footsteps. To me, I learned late after talking to her a lot, she meant dress shoes, you know, hard foot walking up and down the driveway. I believe that was Mark Furman and Roberts, his partner, because they had come up there at 1 o'clock and walked back and forth. Now, here's Furman, who makes all of these wonderful reports. I saw melted ice cream at 10. He's got all these notes detailed. He leaves out, pardon me, the fact that he interviewed Rosa Lopez. And that would be important to learn what she said. But see, in my opinion, he did that to find out if she saw him go plant that glove under the air conditioner. I think I said that on Larry King, and he about, you know, dropped the mic. And this is, I'm talking about right after the verdict, I'm thinking this. Because by that time, I am so convinced that this detective, with a horrific hatred towards black people, number one, but especially black men married to white women, okay, or even dating women. And so I'm jumping around a little bit, but learning all I did about Furman up until the time he cross-examined by Lee, I had, I want to say, six black binders, three-inch binders of papers and interviews and stuff about this guy, prior cases. So when Lee cross-examined him, again, the media says, oh, the old man lost his fastball. Mark Furman was great on the stand. All of them were saying that. And when he come off the stand, Sherry, whatever her name was, the prosecutor, and he was surrounded. They would surround him, you know, at the break. Oh, you're doing great, Mark. And I was sitting in the front row, or not in the front, inside the rail behind the defense table. So I would just not say anything. And of course, they knew that he was my guy because people that I had interviewed told the prosecutor. So they're kind of up my behind about maybe I'm doing something wrong or whatever, you know, like I'm part of trashing this wonderful cop. And all I'm doing is gathering facts. I'm not going to, I don't stand in front of a jury. I don't do anything. I get the stuff and give it to the lawyer like Lee and Johnny. And, you know, we'd have our meetings and go, God almighty, this guy planted the glove, and we could go for 10 hours. I could go with you for the next week on this, all the various little pieces that put together to show, you know, Simpson had no time to do this. And if he had no time, how does the glove get to Rockingham? So we always postulated that the glove was taken by Furman up there somewhere between 1 and 4, because if you recall, Van Adder and Lang don't come on the case until 4 in the morning and Furman gets kicked off. Well, Furman has a prior knowledge of O.J. and Nicole having a fight, so he has a, more of a motivation to plant the glove than O.J. does have a motivation to kill the mother of his children in what we've now nailed down. This is after the trial. We've done a timeline on Goldman. So we did all our timelines that never occurred to us, and it really wasn't me. It was a fellow that did a website that marked that Ron Goldman really never even got to Nicole's house till about 10:30. And that's from all the testimony of the people at Metzaloon, et cetera, et cetera. And he went home to shower and all that. And you can go on and on about Goldman. But the 10:15 is total BS, okay? We blow that right out of the water. And their own people on Bundy, they all kind of blow that. No, no, no. I didn't hear a dog at 10 because I heard this. So the only one in the world that says he hears the plaintiff wail of a dog is Pablo Fenyevs, who I also discovered during the trial. I didn't discover it. It was sent to me. Were two screenplays that he had written for submission to HBO, slasher-type movies, were in the first lines of both of these different, totally different screenplays. He's got language like, in the darkness, in the distance, the plaintive wail of a police siren could be heard. That screenplay stuff to get a movie started. So here he uses plaintive wail in two different screenplays, and then he comes in. It makes me laugh when I think about this. I can only imagine when they heard this guy's statement in the DA's office, oh, that's it, the plaintive wail of a dog. The dog saw his master being killed, started to cry. I mean, they must have lost their minds thinking, we got it now. This is, I mean, they had to, because it's ridiculous. That's probably the only time in the history of the world that they time a murder on a plaintive wail of a dog and ignore, attack, and belittle the human beings on Bundy that came forward. You know, see something, say something, all that law enforcement loves. Well, they had all these people. They had 8 or 10 people that came forward and said, no, the dog starts barking at 10:35, 10:40, 10 whatever. We had the dog walkers and the people in the neighborhood and all that stuff. So our timeline was really close to the truth. And even since then, I think Tom Lang and Ben Adder in their book have agreed that the timeline was more closer to 10:30. They pushed it to 10:30, 10:35. Either way, if you believe the government's case, then you believe this murder happened at 10:15. And guess what? You want to believe 2 and 2 is 9? Have a nice day. I'm sick of arguing with, and trust me, Gus, 26 years of arguing with friends, family, criminal defense lawyers, everybody. And I must say, both black and white people, my black and white friends say, Mac, you're crazy, you're full of beans. You know, he did it, blah, blah, blah. And so the timeline was bulletproof. And so you go, this guy had 20, when you really examine Goldman, this guy has about 21 to 22 minutes to get over there, get in a rage, kill two people, one of whom arrived on the scene. So if he's going to kill Nicole, he has no idea that he's now going to confront a second person and have to kill that person.
Who's 20 years younger than him.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing, we didn't ever want to say, oh, he's arthritic, he couldn't have done it. Well, you just put this stuff out there for people with common sense at the end of a trial to start to think about everything. We didn't even need that. You know, but it came to the point where the timeline was so bulletproof that who cares? Not who cares if he had arthritis and all that, but really, if you knew him then, this wasn't the guy that ran for 2,000 yards. I mean, this guy was beat up and, you know, walking slow and all that sort of stuff. So he would have had to come in to be Superman or be on drugs. That was another big theory. Oh, he got on drugs. Well, you know, he obviously had his blood and everything else, and there was no drugs in his blood, and none in Goldman, none in Nicole. So all that kind of stuff was crazy.
With the timeline, just real quick, too, I think it's so important when you talk about Pablo Fenves. This is the only prosecution witness who's in the vicinity, the neighborhood where the murders happen at Bundy, and saying, oh, right, I think it's 10:15 where this plaintive wail happens, and we're going to use that as the timeline. All the other witnesses who live in that area, folks like Denise Pilnack, who's on the phone and says, hey, I kicked my friend out. She was on the computer and she has phone records and everything to log and say, I think this happened close to like 10:35 or something. And couple that's walking by at like 10:25 and say, hey, I don't hear anything. I don't see anything. I think it's maybe later we don't see, or there's no signs of a murder or struggle. Most of these people, like Denise Pilnack, and Hadystra, I think I'm mispronouncing his name, but he says the hey, Hadystra, and these people, many of them, they too think O.J. Simpson is guilty. It's not like they're coming forward to testify and say, oh yeah, I think this happened at 10:35 because I think the juice is innocent. That's not it at all. Right. They think it happened at 10:35, but they still think O.J. did it, even though their testimony would tend to exonerate him. Just, can you speak to that too?
Yes, because all of them thought the same thing. All of them, including Laura with the tape, she thought he did it, you know. But I would go to people, and one of the witnesses never came. I don't know if Lee talked about him, a guy named Tom Lang. who was down the, lives on Bundy, was walking his dog at 10 o'clock. He's really the last guy that ever saw these people alive other than the killer. He sees them at about 10 o'clock as he's walking up the street. And his story, I corroborated six ways to Sunday, you know, with his wife and the timing. And he heard some party noises. I found out there was a dinner party on Dorothy. I found those people that had the party that he's talking about. And, you know, he sees two people. He sees Nicole. He's the last one. And I remember saying to Lee back then, they were, everybody's quizzing about it. Johnny had misgivings about Tom Lang because of he saw a white Ford vehicle. I said, Johnny, I talked to this guy. He saw a white Ford F-350. It's much bigger than a Bronco. Well, he could have made a mistake. I said, Johnny, I did refer the background on the guy. He's owned 11 Ford vehicles. He knows a Bronco from a 250 or 350 or a 150. He knows it wasn't a Bronco, it was this. So that was kind of important. But Johnny made the call. We're not going to use him because we're late in the trial and all that stuff. But I really lobbied to get this guy. But he was the same way. He was a guy that I finally, he called me finally. I left my card a number of times, met his wife. Here's my name. And he finally calls back. He says, come on out here. And so I go to his house and he says, you know why I'm going to talk to you? Why? He said, the only person to come to my house like a judge. You had a suit and tie on every time. You were very polite to my wife. I'm so sick of tabloid people and everybody banging on my door, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, you know, that's how I operate. And thank you for talking to me. And so we start talking. Now, I know his police report inside out. And he starts telling me, well, I was walking. He said, do you want to see the walk? I said, sure, let's walk. Let's do the whole thing. And so we walk up. He shows me where he was, where he commanded his dog, et cetera. And we get back to his house. And I said, did you tell this to the police? He said, yeah. But they didn't want to go on a walk with me. But, yeah. And he's starting to tell me how, listen, your client, you know, he's got the cut finger. Come on now. You know, your client's guilty. I said, it doesn't matter. I wasn't there and you weren't there. And you were there closer than I was. But all I want to know is the truth. So whatever you got to tell me that's truth, I just fit it in. If it fits in the puzzle, great. If not, if it hurts us, it hurts us. That's the lawyer's problem, not ours. So he said, no, I never saw my police report. So he describes her dress and all that. Oh, better than that. So I show him his police report. He said, that's not what I said. I didn't tell him it was a white dress because the police report's got him seeing Nicole in a blonde in a long white flowing gown. Well, she was wearing that black cocktail dress or the little short dress that she had on the recital that she was found dead in. So he says, no, I didn't say that. And so I said, did they walk with you? Did you? No, they didn't want to walk with me. He said, and you know what? I took notes. And I said, you took notes? He said, yeah, I took notes. You want to see him? I go, yeah, sure. So he gives me his notes that he wrote. I said, well, what made you write these down? He said, well, because when I got home the next day from work, I saw the police and everything and it's on TV, the murder, and I remembered that night. So I wrote down what I recalled with my wife. I said, well, here's what happened. Now we can't get through to the LAPD for the same reasons nobody could get through to anybody. The phones are blown off hooks everywhere. So he says, not only did I have these notes, the cop didn't want them. I said, well, could I have a copy? Yeah. He gives me a copy. And he says, you know, I went to my job the next day. I told my boss, a guy, Bill something, his name escapes me right now. He's passed away. But his boss was a lawyer by trade, but he was the general manager of the, it was right there now, and the name escapes me, a national hotel chain right there at the beach in Santa Monica. I don't know if it was a Ramada, not a Ramada Inn, but some kind of hotel right there. He says, no. So I went in and told my boss, and the boss says, well, listen, here's my tape recorder. Dictate your recollections. So now he does all of that and does the same thing again. And they transcribe it. They get a court report, transcribe the thing. He says, you want that? I said, please. So I got all this. And, you know, he was pretty close on his details of what he saw and everything. And he saw, you know, Nicole. He couldn't see who was in this white Ford F-350. But he said they were either embracing or pushing away. And we now know it must have been pushing away. They certainly weren't probably embracing. But he also saw, in his words, a man in an angry stance right in front of her gate. Describes this man as white, Asian, or Hispanic, but not African American. So he also thought he saw somebody in the street. So it's telling me, and I told Lee this, I said, these people that he saw were not friends, because everybody in the world has come forward. We must have 500,000 people have come forward saying, oh, I knew this, I there, and there. Nothing about this scene that Tom Lang, and I don't think he's making this up, none of these people that he observed have come forward to say, oh, yeah, I was over at Nicole's at 10 o'clock, and, you know. And so I said, these got to be the guys. So we always, and there's more than one guy there, which fits with the more than one murderer. So that was so important to me anyway, as an investigator. And like you say, just like everybody else on Bundy, they thought Simpson was guilty. But when you get people talking, you get, you know, and you corroborate what they're saying with their, and Denise is the best one, Denise Pilnack, because she actually has an official record. She has a phone record that corroborates her story with the time, right? So, and Danny Mendel and Aronson, the two that were on a date from Metaluna, we had their receipt, and then we walked with them. We walked from Metaluna past there. They were very cooperative a dozen times, you know, to try to figure out the time that they would have been in front of Nicole's place. And I forget the other people there. The gal that was at the party. So I forget her. I'm drawing a blank right now. But anyway, we had all these people that, as a cop, you could have, between them and Arnell and other people, you could have eliminated O.J. Simpson. And I've said this to a million people. Had this been Dan Marino or Joe Montana or some other famous white football player whose wife was murdered, and you sat down and you came in and you gave him a full statement, you give him your blood, you give him everything, they would have walked and they would have said, okay. And if you had, you know, cops that knew what they're, I shouldn't say knew what they were doing, but cops that didn't have a racial angle like Furman and them, you would have eliminated them. And you should have eliminated Simpson, even though he should be your first potential suspect, but you could eliminate the guy and then start talking to these people like Tom Lang, what they look like, well, you know, get more detail. But no, they lost their minds when Furman went over the wall and came back out with the glove. If you recall Furman, basically, when he says, I know where Simpson lives, because he had been there before. They all go up there, all four lead detectives leave a murder crime scene and go up to, quote, in their words, was to make a notification of next of kin. Well, you never do that. You pick up some other poor cop has that duty to notify family of you know. So, but no, all the lead guys, they go up to Rockingham. And again, every time Furman leaves these guys for a couple of seconds, voila, evidence. So they're all standing there at the Ashford gate, beeping. Of course, no one's answering. Arnell's sleeping. She's not, the thing doesn't ring in her place. It's ringing in the main house. Furman leaves them. All of a sudden, hey, look what I found. There's blood on the Bronco. And they all go, you know, following over there, and it's dark, and he's shining a flashlight. And before they know it, he's hopping the wall. And that story about, you know, like they knew he was going to, it was all BS. He just hopped the wall and opened the gate.
How did you come to that conclusion that that's a lie, that this was not some, hey, we think he's in danger and we all agree that he just, hey, I'm going to hop the wall, and then they just have to sign on it afterwards?
Yeah, that was all BS, please. That was, he jumped the wall. Now, you know, as you look back, you're making your story up. The police are making up a story about why they did this. They knew you can't go in there without a search warrant, but they did anyway, and they said, oh, we thought somebody was dead in there. So, you know, there's other injuries. And it's like, oh, now we have another murder scene or potential scene, which is, you know, just made up out of whole cloth. But again, now they hop the fence. Now they're going in there. They're looking for Arnell. They get Arnell. And so she comes around and says, oh, my God, they love Nicole, too. I mean, it's like, Jesus. So she's freaking out, crying and everything else. Where's your devil? He's in Chicago, and I have a number. We'll have to call Kathy. He has a Hertz function. Of course, none of that's in the search warrant affidavit. They go, Arnell's told us, meaning Banatter, that OJ left in the middle of the night to play golf. Well, that sounds ridiculous, right? When I first heard that, who leaves their house and plays across the country to play golf in the next morning without, it doesn't make sense. Well, found out later when I talked to Hertz people, this was planned away in advance. So he didn't leave in the middle of the night. So when the judge, before he signed the search warrant, he said, wait a minute. How do you know that O.J. Simpson left just in the middle of the night? And they wrote, because Arnell told us. I forget what they were. Those were what we called the six lies that were in the search warrant affidavit. Again, and that's after, I skipped the part about they're in the house. They sit at the bar by the pool, in O.J.'s kitchen and pool table room, trophy room, all that. And they're sitting there. And, of course, Furman leaves them, once again, leaves the three detectives. Phillips on the phone, calling O.J. at the O'Hare Plaza. Tom Lang and Banatter are talking to Arnell. Furman goes and finds Cato, thinks he's on drugs because Cato looks like, is a goofball. What's he even doing there? So they're, Furman's giving him a Stiglitz test and all that with the flashlight, thinks he's high. Here's about the three bumps or thumps or whatever Cato says he heard. So Furman is not dumb. Furman is basically at his best at his craft, which is planting evidence on black defendants. He is a superb planter of evidence on innocent black people, and he had a couple of prior cases. So his mind is thinking, let me go get that glove that I stuck in the Bronco. I thought we'll catch later and go put it under the air conditioner. So that was when Lee cross examined him. I mean, just a BS story that he went back there with his little flashlight and found this thing. He put it there, and plus, again, let's talk logically. So you're saying that O.J. Simpson kills these two people, gets rid of everything. Knives, the murder weapons, the most important stuff, all the clothes, and brings a glove back to his own home, and then says, I hid it inside the house. And he bumps into the air conditioner, not once, not twice, three times. Well, O.J. would probably, as a former running back, if he hit the air conditioner, probably would have ducked the second time. He wouldn't have hit it twice and then backed up and ran into it the third time, in his own property. So it was just, to us, insane that that's your theory. This is insane. It's far more logical that glove got, because there's nothing else there. His house, the carpeting in there was white through most of the place, up the stairway and everything. There was no blood in this house. That crap about all this blood and all that stuff, there was nothing. They found some drop that he even admits, I think I nicked myself and got a little. And they make it like there's this trail of blood from this crime scene, which was really nuts. I was always focused on Furman. And again, it was my only case at the time. So I spent every night of a year out there on Bundy, out there rocking, listening, watching, just for noises. And, I took OJ's girlfriend, she also had a Bronco. OJ's was in custody. AC Collins is, I think, was in. I forget whose car was where, but Paula had one. I used to drive that thing, see how fast I could get from Bundy to Rockingham, and OJ told me the fastest way to get there. Remember, we had the girl that said, I saw him in AC.
Jill Shively. Jill Shively. That's the one. They wheel her out about every other year. OJ Simpson ran me off the road. He just killed Nicole and Ron, and then he ran me off the road trying to race home. And I just like, do you find any credibility in her story at all?
No, do I? Hell no. And it was, like, well, wait a minute. If that really happened, where are the people that almost had this accident? This is the most notorious thing on television worldwide. If you almost had an accident with a white Bronco at San Vicente and Bundy at 11 o'clock or whatever time she was saying, you know, they would have come forward. There was no evidence of that. And she had people on the sidewalk that saw this, according to her. That woman is a complete liar. And actually, she snookered one of the best, at least I thought it was, a big law firm out there, Marty Singer and whatever that firm is. I shouldn't say Marty because I'm not sure it was him. But there was a firm that was that threatened to sue this guy that had done a website about Jill Shively. And so I remember calling the lawyer. I said, I got this complaint because the guy gave it to me. He says, could you help me with this? I said, sure. So I called the guy. I'm thinking, you know, I'm calling a good law firm. I say, hey, here's who I am. And I think this woman made up this complaint because it was really crappy. It wasn't put together well. Like, you know, I'm working with lots of big law firms, and that goes through six guys before it goes out the door, you know, before it goes to a judge. It's proofed and edited and, you know, all that sort of stuff. He goes, no, that's my client. I said, well, you must have got snookered. This woman's a liar. Well, and he's getting a little aggressive. You guys, I said, no, us guys didn't do anything. This woman inserts herself, Dr. Phil, Dr. Joe, everywhere she can get on TV, and they make a big dramatic scene with her. And we, and this website that this friend of mine put together, Brian Heiss, he really lays it out well. She's just a crazy lunatic. And by the way, she's sitting in the office telling this story when another detective walks down the hall and sees her and says, what are you talking to her for? I locked her. She's crazy. She sued some actor. She swindled some guy out of $250,000. I don't know all these Hollywood actors and stuff, but she had swindled someone. And so they threw her out. And, of course, Marcia says, well, she sold her story to the Inquirer. That's why we didn't use her at the grand jury. I'm thinking, well, you used Hector Camacho and the other guy. Not Hector. That's the boxer. Camacho and the other guy from Ross Cutlery. They sold their story for $12,500 to the National Enquirer. You put them in front of the grand jury. So spare me your sanctimonious crap about we didn't call her because she had sold her story. Okay, they realized she was full of shite, and they didn't. That's why they didn't use her. Oh, I got along with Marcia. I used to bust her chops all the time about this in breaks and stuff. I, you know, and still do. And last time I talked to her, I kind of still like to break her shoes a little bit about that. She curses me out. And
Marcia Clark conceded in her book that Jill Shively was a liar. In fact, she can see she makes it very explicit in saying that she didn't knowingly give false testimony to the grand jury, but after the fact she realized that she did, because she concedes Jill Shively is not a credible witness. It's not just because she got money for selling her story to Hard Copy or whatever the tabloid was, but it's because exactly what you said. She has a history of swindling people and just lying and making up things like, she probably didn't see this, not going to bring her up in trial. Like, woof, this could be, I mean, it's way beyond just she sold money. She is not credited. It's lots of this, just having people that are totally not credible, who are just making up things to push along this totally goofy narrative that O.J. Simpson went and hacked up these people in the house where his children were asleep, that he hacked them up and raced across town and did all this in like 5 minutes and buried the knife and shit. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. It's totally. And it I'm even crazy. More embarrassed because I used to be one of the people who believed this. It took us literally up until weeks ago. We started reading Jeffrey Toobin's book, who also says O.J. Simpson did it. So we're not even reading a book that's, he didn't do it.
Don't feel too bad, because I'm just like you. I thought he was guilty when I got hired. Okay, so when I go out there, all I know is what I've seen on television and in the media. Yeah. I'm thinking, oh, my God, we got problems here. A boy is, you know, and then when I finally see him at the jail, I still wanted to, you know, because we're hearing, like everybody else, oh, O.J.'s socks are on the floor with Nicole's blood in them. Thank God we were able to pull all that together and find out that, I think his name was Willie Ford, who was the videographer, that, you know, because O.J. sees these crime scenes. I remember I took the pictures out there. He's going nuts. What is this? My socks weren't on the floor. My bed wasn't all unmade. You know, Gigi gets my stuff. I put it all, you know, he has a whole routine. And I used to travel a lot doing my work, and I kind of related to this routine. You know, you pack at the last minute, just like he did, and you get tired of getting on planes and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, the sock, to me, was another – that's a bigger plant than the glove. We know Furman did the glove, but the sock was to add, you know, for them. And if you look at the timing of this sock story – his OJ, like he said, and Gigi the maid confirms that he takes his clothes off, throws him in the hamper, takes his he lays out the clothes he's going to wear, gets out of the shower, puts those on, his dirty clothes or whatever, and he had played golf that day. I don't think he threw it. I think he hung his he had dockers. I forget the, you know, Gap or some kind of pants that he wore for golf. He hung those back up because, you know, he played golf in them. But his socks and everything else he threw in the hamper. When he saw this picture, he's going, what is this? This is a crime. And so they kind of, I think they made it look like the room was a little disheveled, you know, to add to the whole, well, he had to be running or he has no time. So let's make it look like, geez, he threw stuff everywhere. The house is a mess and all that. And it's just stuff they did that you don't do, you know. It's you know, you're not seen, evidently, so they don't realize that, oh, wait a minute, you know, we're doing all this, but the next morning the first guy on the scene is a videographer and that stuff is in the pardon me, it's not on the floor. Okay, so that stuff got thrown on the floor after the videographer, who's in there to preserve everything as it is, you know, and document it and film it and all that. So we have that sort of behavior. And listen, this is no different in my, this is my opinion, than the guy that kneeled on the guy's neck in Minnesota.
George,
this
boy
was Mark Furman tried to kneel on Simpson's neck, but he didn't kill him. He tried to, and they kind of went on, and cops, I shouldn't say all cops, I don't want anybody to think I'm saying all cops, but they tend to believe the detectives, and all of a sudden this was the whole, well, read the backs of the books and the I Thank You, this and that, Tom Lang, these, they had LAPD, the New York PD, the FBI, they had everybody in law enforcement hoping to put a hat on O.J. Simpson. I mean, speaking of books, I just finished a book with Lee Bailey. It'll come out in June. Hope your readers put that in their book club, because you'll see that not only do we talk about all this in better detail than I am right now, but we have a website that you could say, the sock, for example. So we have a whole timeline of the sock, and you can go click on it and see the grand jury testimony and or the police reports. But the sock, for example, was taken in by the LAPD crime lab. So there's a report from them with a date in June. No blood was observed. It's even written in one of the reports, no blood observed on this sock.
Wow.
It was looked at by our people, Henry Lee, Michael Bodden, Barbara Wolf. It was also looked at by the California crime lab. No one observed blood. It was never sent to the FBI. And yet, in September, it comes out that Nicole's blood is all over the sock. And remember, the place was, I mean, it was like, oh, you know, every in the courtroom, oh, you know. And so we're going nuts, going, what are you talking about? And to me, it was another, you know, they portrayed us as being against the police. And we were trashing the police. And for those old enough to remember, everybody ran around L.A. with blue ribbons on in support of the police, right? And all we were dirty people trying to mess with beautiful, honorable police officers, which, you know, we only had two that we were looking at that we really thought were dirty. and Furman was the main one. But the timing of this report was Tracy Savage from NBC, who we learned later was having an affair with Gascon, the flack for the police department. And so Marsha steps up in court and says, that's impossible. It hasn't even been sent to the FBI lab yet, right? So it can't be true. So what happens? The next day, NBC again confirmed, we have gone back to our sources, and we can confirm that Nicole's blood is on that sock. And we're all going, well, how do you know it hasn't been tested yet? Well, the reason they knew is we think that someone told Gascon, so whoever planted that, and we had our suspicions that it was Michelle Kessler, because she was married to a robbery homicide detective. So it was kind of a us against them war, with them being in the police and law enforcement, everybody else saying that us, the defense team, were these slimy people that were just slipping and sliding and trying to do something. We had, you know, a bunch of the best lawyers in the country, and everybody's working hard, and we didn't pull any stunts. You talk about stunts, Christ, I could write a whole book just on the stunts that the prosecution and the cops did in this case. But that sock, to me, was greater evidence, and it happened, the timing of that was the day after, if I recall, I know I'm close on this, I might not be specific, but when Ito denied the motion to suppress, we tried to get the gloves impressed, and he denied it, but he did say that Van Atter had a complete disregard for the truth, which is basically saying, you're an effing liar, okay? Mm-hmm. And so they went nuts, and we used to think that someone got so aggravated at us, the defense, that they salted up that sock and then leaked the Gascon. Hey, because he doesn't know. He's a PR guy. Nicole's blood's on the sock. He goes to his girlfriend, Tracy Savage. She goes on TV and tells this whole story and then confirms it the second day. So to me, it was like she had to go back and say, Jesus, they're saying it didn't happen. He had to go to whoever planted that or whoever told him that, and they said, Nicole's blood is on the sock. That's my theory, and it's a lot better than their theory, which was O.J. Simpson was wearing the dress socks that he wore to the recital, and those crazy Bruno Mali story, and whatever else, and got rid of everything except came home and put the socks in the dryer, I mean in the hamper. Oh, geez, I could go for hours on the insanity as an investigator anyway of how this case got away. And then, you know, I had no idea that the whole world, the world, the white world, and probably a lot of black people, too, that I'm friends with say that they thought Simpson was guilty, you know. And it just, excuse me, it was the narrative of the media, frankly. And, you know, basically, like Tubin, Jeffrey and I got along great. I mean, we've been to dinner a few times, lunch, because, you know, a lot of reporters would want to go to lunch, talk to him, and I go, the guy didn't do it. Oh, come on, Pat, what do you got? I go, well, you're going to see in trial. But I always said the same thing. He didn't have time. He didn't have time to kill the two people. What about the blood? Well, you know, and I would never, I just say the guy didn't have time. And frankly, 26 years later, it's the same. The man did not have, he had 22 minutes to pull this off, and it cannot be done. And then hide everything to never be found ever again. But Jeffrey and I many a time go out. And when he was writing his book, he came to Florida. He wanted to talk. He did a long interview. I gave him or showed him Pablo Fenyev's two screenplays that have plaintiff Whale. Jeffrey kind of, well, his mind's made up that Simpson did it. Just like Dan Abrams, everybody out there that I kind of was friends with all said the same thing. You know, you guys are doing a great job, but this guy did it. You know, I know he did it. You know, I mean, how do you know he did it? Dan Abrams said that. He just said, I just did a podcast with, I was the only defense person to agree to go on Kim Goldman's podcast.
Oh, that's right.
And, you know, I, we were, you know, I, just to cover my butt, I had my end of it taped here. You know, I had my secretary put a camera on a tripod just because I knew I was going to get chopped up.
Wow. You were the only person taking the perspective that Mr. Simpson was innocent on Kim Goldman's podcast?
Yep.
Wow.
And I said, you know, you're not going to like what I got to say to her producer. I think Nancy Glass or Glassman or something, Nancy Glass Productions. I said, but I'll do it. And it was arranged by a guy that I know that's a PR type guy. I think it was Goldman's PR person, Michael Wright, who I've met on a number of high profile homicide cases because I got the homicide defendant. And he's usually representing the family. So I've met him a number of times. And he's the one that kind of arranged it. He said, no, McKenna's the right guy. He's done this other other cases, and he's, you know, he does the right thing, or whatever they said. I don't know. So, and I remembered saying to her, she said something like, I don't think this made it either, because I know I talked to her for, God, an hour and a half, and I think I'm on there for 12 minutes. But she said something about, well, I don't want this to be confrontational. And I remember saying, Kim, when it comes to O.J. Simpson, I ain't afraid of confrontation. But I got to tell you, I'm bored with it because no one wants to everybody wants to believe 2 and 2 is 9. And I'm now to the point, it's like, have a nice day. If you want to believe that, you can. I'm not going to argue it anymore, just like I don't argue with people that won't wear a mask. It's the two categories I say, I'm not talking to these people. Or at least I'm not arguing with them. But, you know, Kim was at least kind enough to give me an hour and a half. She didn't like what I had to say. And then I think after it was over, because I think I had it somewhere, and they're going, oh, this guy's bonkers. Yeah, I was never bonkers. I mean, if I'm bonkers, I don't know how the hell I keep getting good work with some of the best lawyers in the country. But, you know, and I want to say, Kim, you should really be, you know, pissed off at Mark Furman and some of the proof, because they really let your family down. And I have nothing but, I guess, sympathy or empathy for a murder victim's family. I don't know how I'd probably be crazy, and you know? I'd be jumping across the railing and punching people if it was my kid that was killed. So I understand the rage and all that, but if you do a critical look at this and go back and say, well, your Boyer took the Fifth Amendment. Nobody on our team took the Fifth Amendment. He took the Fifth Amendment. They make it like even Tom, I've seen Tom, who I always got along with during the case, Tom Lang, say, yeah, we were mad he took the Fifth Amendment. They were all pissed off at Furman for taking the Fifth. Well, why do you think he did it? I've never been in a case where the detective came to the stand with a criminal defense lawyer standing next to the witness box telling him, you ain't answering anything, okay? So when I say that to people, they go, well, I don't remember that. I go, well, go look at the
I don't remember that.
Yeah. And Furman, and they all knew that I was doing Furman, right? And after Lee crossed him, and all the stories, oh, Bailey Fall lost his fastball, Furman was great, blah, blah, blah. We didn't know about the tapes. The tapes came in July. That was kind of like just, you know, I've got most of my work done. I'm still working out there, and I got this little, you know, tip. And I used to follow up. Well, I didn't get a tip. I used to get like $1 million a day. We had made a chart at Johnny's office because they were overwhelmed with phone calls coming in. So we'd make a chart. Joe Blow calling, here's his phone number, here's what he does, and here's what he's got to say. Well, so, and God bless her, Jan, the receptionist there, she would write everybody down. And so I would go through this chart every day, sometimes it'd be 12, 18 pages of names and numbers. And, you know, when you say, this lady here, she's a psychic, I don't need to go any further. That's, I don't follow that call. And this one, and that one. But I would follow calls for anything to do with Furman or planting evidence or anything. You get a call from, say, I remember a doctor saying, my own doctor that just did a surgery on me for skin cancer. It was in the office, and the girl was taking gauze and putting the blood. It was in my chest, so she'd keep putting the blood in the thing, and he followed the case. He gives me grief all the time about DNA and blood and all that stuff, and I said, there's more blood in the garbage can right here. And you are very, very protected here. You're wearing the shields on your face, and it's very controlled, and the little incision, and you're dabbing and lasering and closing the cut and all that stuff. and look at the blood that's in this garbage can compared to a few nanograms of Simpsons, which was far more consistent with a planting than it was a guy just stabbed two people to death. He had blood in his eyelashes, for God's sakes. So I'd take calls like that, you know, from doctors saying, oh, I'm an OBGYN. We do a cesarean section. And, oh, my God, everybody's got gowns and masks. And it's very controlled. And yet we have blood on our shoes. We have it everywhere. You know, so there were a lot of people that would call in. And I would kind of give calls back to those folks, say who I was, thank you for your information. And then I got the Furman stuff, you know. And trust me, I got stuff about Furman every day. But a lot of it would be crazy, so I wouldn't follow up.
What do you mean? Wait a minute. You said a lot of it would be crazy. Crazy like what?
Well, crazy like I was with Furman that night. You know, we were on a break at the hotel, and you know, he told me he was going to do, you know, just stuff that, you know, I was somewhere with Mark Furman and he told me he did it, you know, stuff like that. But those kind of crazy, trust me, if you knew how many crazies called in, it used to be a joke, you know, because I was the guy that had to deal with them all. Everybody else was in court and, you know, there were guys would come to Johnny's office. It got to the point where I wouldn't bring them back anymore. I'd just sit out in the lobby because there were just too many kooks. I didn't want these people back in Johnny's office. But I remembered the Furman call, the tapes, and the way it went down is a little different than the movie that Jeff did. But the actual way it went down was I see this call, and if it said planting evidence, and then the N-word. Those were the calls I would follow up on. So I'd follow up on this call. And I called. A man answers the phone. I go, and this is late in the game. This is like almost at the end of the trial. And I go, my name is Pat McKenna. Dead silence. I figured by now, I mean, we've been in Time Magazine all over the planet. Our name's everywhere. So it's nothing. I go, okay. Is Laura there? And he goes, well, Laura, and now this guy's in North Carolina. I said, this is Pat McKenna. I'm in Los Angeles. I was calling, is Laura there? No, she's at the store. She'll be back in 15. Can you take my name and number? Sure. So all I had was her name. And somewhere I still got the scrap of yellow paper that I was writing this note on, because I had so many scraps of paper. I mean, you know, just trying to write everything down. I didn't have like a real organized legal pad every day in my hand. So I'd have scraps of paper and I had a yellow legal sheet and I had the area code. I think it was 707. And I remembered I make my own little notes, Raleigh ? Cause by then I know the area codes every place in the freaking country. And so 404 was whatever, Georgia, and 410. So I write Raleigh ? And I kind of leave it alone. And back then, I had an office in the back in Johnny's office. And so they had not caller ID, but they had a little thing that would give you the number that was calling in. This is 94, so you didn't have really. But you would have the number, and I see the same number. So I get, you know, I get my pen and paper ready and all that. I pick up the phone, and all I have is a first name. And the answer is, oh, and before this happens, the guy that left the tips was telling me she's gonna refer you to her lawyer who's in Los Angeles, but she has these tapes, you need to listen to them. And I remember writing, I think Tubin puts this in his book, that because he's telling me the story about planting evidence, he uses the N-word, niggers, and then I forget the third thing, and I didn't realize that I kept with my pen. So the word niggers has come, I've written over it six times, you know, because it was just something unconscious I'm writing, thinking, you know, that was important. I want to hear this. So anyway, she calls, hi, it's Laura Hart McKinney. Boom, I write down Hart McKinney. And I remember saying, this is different the way TV, it sounded like it was a little confrontational, the actor that played me or whatever. I wasn't at all. I said, my name is Pat McKenna. I'm a private investigator. I got a tip that you had tapes on Mark Furman. I said, in my heart of hearts, I believe this man's innocent. And just give me a 2 seconds. And I was on the phone with her quite a while. And by the time I got done, she agrees that she would have her lawyer call me. And that was about it. minutes later, I get a call from, I think the lawyer was Matt Schwartz and Ron Regwan in Los Angeles. So, and then I meet them and I talk to them and they're saying, no, she's got these tapes. We've heard these tapes. You probably, and they don't know who I am. They're not knowing if I'm who I say. I mean, I said, well, listen, let me do that. They said, we want a letter from Johnny. I said, well, Johnny, this is 8 o'clock at night. I said, Johnny's gone. I think Carl's in the oven. Carl or Sean are still here. Carl Douglas and Sean Chapman. One of them's probably still here. I go to Carl's office. And if you knew Carl, you know, me and Carl had a great relationship. And he look at, I go, Carl, I got a hot one. I think I got some stuff on Furman. Pat, I got this to do. Please leave me some time. You know, I said, can I, the lawyer from Los Angeles says he's heard the tapes. Pat, I got no time. I said, do you mind if I dictate a letter to Carmen? That was his secretary. And for your signature. Sure. Just go do it. So I dictate this letter. Hi. You know, this is Carl. I wrote it in Carl's name. Said Pat McKenna's our investigator, but please cooperate. And then we fax it over. And of course, back then, I grabbed everything. You know, like back in those days, you put a fax and it came out with a confirmation. So I've got all my ends. I'm making a whole file because I'm starting to, you know, get a little excited. Maybe there is something here. And so that was the beginning of it. And then I frankly didn't want to even hear these because I didn't want to be them in my hands or anything. Cause I said, well, if this is real, they're going to leak this shit. Whoops. Excuse me. Didn't mean to swear on your show. They're going to leak this. I've already been accused by Shapiro of leaking everything, even though I never did leak anything. So I didn't want to be accused of leaking. So I sit back and the lawyers took over, Johnny and them. And I remember having lunch with Jerry Ullman the next day. Johnny wanted me to meet with Jerry, tell him how this all went down. And, you know, so lawyers can have the whole timeline of how it happened. So they're getting their motion ready. I remember Jerry saying, Pat, this is like manna from heaven. And I'll never forget that. He said, this is manna from heaven. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, it's good, but we've already crushed these people. I mean, this jury should be out in 2 minutes, you know, because I'm very confident that we've shown that Simpson couldn't have done it. I'm not watching TV every night, you know, and all the shows. So that's how that thing went down. And, you know, kind of the rest is history. I finally met Laura and her husband when they came to L.A., and she's a lovely lady, but she felt horrible thinking that she was the reason Simpson got acquitted. And I remember saying to afterwards to, I think a TV producer was trying to do a show on the tapes and they were interviewing her and he said, well, she's just overwhelmed with guilt that she got. I said, no, tell her this, this will assuage her guilt. These tapes really were nothing compared to what we already had. We had this guy committing perjury. We got everything. We got the timeline. I was so confident we were going to win that the tapes were just like extra. And so, you know, lo and behold, we had that big fight and all that. And we get the tapes. And frankly, most of America's never listened to these tapes, unless they were listening to the trial that day. But if you, I have them all. When you listen to this over and over again, and during the trial when Ito's playing these, of course, he doesn't let the jury hear him. I remember walking around Johnny's office and all of his employees, all the women at all the desks, were women of color, black or brown, etc. And of course they all loved me. I was always goofing and cutting up and all that stuff when it was time to do that. I was serious when it would be serious, but you know, I have a good person to run around. I remember walking around, you could hear a pin drop in there, and the looks on these people's faces was heartbreaking to me. And they would look at me, Pat, just like Pat, just with a question, like couldn't even get the question out of their mouth. But it dawned on me, I said, yeah, this isn't surprising to them. It's surprising that this guy's on tape doing this, but these are folks that probably interact with cops all the time, and it's, you know, nothing unusual. Now, look, 26 years later, nothing's changed. I mean, nothing's really changed except it's worse, and it always pisses off my white cop friends when I say this, because they're like, why do you always bring up race? And I go, because in 46 years, it's in my face every day, defending African-Americans or Latinos or whatever, and then seeing cops come in And because it's not Simpson, they get away with this a lot, you know, and put their hand on a Bible and look that jury right in the eye with their uniform crisply pressed on there, say, no, here, bop, 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 and jurors go for it. And that's why we now have, I don't know how many people exonerated off of death row, and there's millions, probably more, or hundreds of thousands or whatever, that have been spending untold years for something they didn't do. I mean, I have two or three right now that, you know, I got one today that's a 1968 murder.
Wow.
I said, geez, I was in Vietnam when this case happened, you know, and the kid, the lawyer, he wasn't even born yet. And yet, you know, they uncovered in an old DA's file all kinds of Brady material. That it's ballistics, it's too long a story to get into, so I'm like jacked up about this case. But this guy's been in custody since 68. How many years? That's 50 years. He could be one of my, you know, longest. I've got a couple others that have spent 30 years and 40 years. And it's just so scary because every time I get this, I think back of, you know, 30 years and what my life has been, okay? A couple of children, a couple of grandchildren, freedom, ball games, fun, this and that. And these people have missed out on a whole lifetime of experiences because of some son of a bitch that got on the stand, put his hand up and lied. And then, you know, the prosecutor went along with it. And, you know, friends, I talk a lot. I say, you know how hard it is to convict an innocent man? Everybody's got to be on the same page. The cops, the prosecutors, the media, the judge. Okay. So the only reason, for example, OJ or Casey Anthony, these people that have juries that are sequestered, they're not listening to that crap on TV. So they sit and they listen to the evidence and they pay attention. They go, man, I don't think so, not guilty. And then people go nuts and bitch about jurors. But I don't know. I'm off on a tangent here. So it gets me so jacked up sometimes talking about this stuff.
It should. It should.
It does. I mean, you know.
With the Furman tapes, I wanted to go back to something that you said because I thought that was so important. And I guess for listeners, too, if you all have a question that you want to ask Mr. McKenna, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question. Mr. F. Lee Bailey, when he was with us a few weeks back, I think he said that out of all of his years practicing law and illustrious victories and what have you, I think he said that that was his proudest moment, or at least one of them. I think he said his proudest moment, though, was getting Mark Furman, getting him to convicted of perjury with that exchange and lying about saying nigger and all that. He said that was one of his proudest moments. And he even said, like, for a double murder to have a police officer convicted of perjury who is the star witness, like, are you kidding? Like, man, it's like some Perry Mason, but with the audio. I thought OJ Simpson was guilty. I said repeatedly, if you had asked me, like, just maybe 2 months ago, if you had asked me, like, okay, Gus, what do you know about Mark Furman? I would have said, oh, okay, OJ Simpson trial, nigger, that's about it. Like, okay, give me some more details. Like, what did he do? What did he say? I couldn't have told you anything. Like, I had not heard any excerpts from the Furman tapes, the audio, like, nothing. And when we started reading the book and going over it, I think most people had not heard any of the tapes. And then when I started to research, and they said, hey, nobody, like none of the major publications, the New York Times, the LA Times, none of them reproduced the unedited versions of what was said. None of the major networks like replayed. Like, if, as you say, if you were not watching that day in court when the jury wasn't there, if you didn't hear it, tough nuggies, you have not heard the unedited. And I mean, just in terms of how Mark Furman has been totally sanitized, where you'll see him on top. Just, can you talk about that in terms of how he's been cleaned up over the past quarter century?
Well, yeah, because it's because everybody wanted to be clean and feel like, oh, we got robbed. These guys got away. The black jurors. I mean, I remember an author saying to me, well, Pat, you know, those fat black lady's got him up. And I said, well, don't you mean those niggers on the jury? Is that, that's what you're saying to me? You're not saying those fat, first of all, that ain't what got him off, you know, and I had a big fight with him, but Furman, yeah, was totally sanitized more than anybody, on Fox News and everything else. But I was friends with Dominic Dunn because he covered many cases that I was on, the Kennedy case and all that. He's always against him, but yeah, I get along with people. So we became friendly. He probably just wanted to befriend me to see if he could, you know, talk and kind of, and I'm just a straight shooter. I just say, well, here's what I think. And so when it came to the OJ, I would see him out there again, and we became somewhat friendly and talkative and all that. And I know he hated the client, and he got Furman a book deal, right, on the other Kennedy situation, the Skagel case. And, well, first he got him the book deal, Murder in Brentwood, okay? So I think they were tight. But, you know, here's the story. I don't know if a lot of people know this. When O.J. was in Vegas on that fiasco, Dominic Dunn apologized to him for his over-the-top coverage in the murder trial, even though he still thinks O.J. was guilty. But I always said, I told Kathy, the O.J.'s secretary, I said, I know what happened here, because I've had dinner with Dominic many a time. I know that he must have got so close to Furman that he realized what kind of person Furman was. Furman probably relaxed with him just like he did with Laura Hart, because you can't, you don't change, right? You don't change yourself. And, you know, they just sanitized him. And I think Dominic Dunn had his fill with the guy, realized what he had. He apologized to OJ. And, you know, Furman just struts around like a sanctimonious peacock with his chest out, like he did nothing wrong, and we are still scumbags. And there's all this evidence and blah, 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 blah. And frankly, it's just, it's sad because he, I don't care if he makes $1 million or whatever, but it was sad to see like Fox News, but now we know what Fox News is. And, geez, can you imagine if they were in existence back then, how they would have crucified Furman? But, you know, they put this guy on TV and basically, you know, stand for him or stand behind him. And the guy is horrific. Gus, if you had the time to listen to all these tapes, you'd be sick to your stomach. You can't believe. And this isn't, what did he say? It was a role for a movie or some shit. They tried to say that he was, sorry, I cussed again. This is only the least amount of cussing I've ever done on an interview. But his story was he was play acting for a movie. Okay. And I've done this with a class of college kids that I get a talk to. And I walked up and I said, well, first of all, you guys don't know me and you probably never see me again, but I think all fucking niggers ought to be put in a pile and burned. And you could hear a pin drop. I go, you'll remember that, won't you? And you'll remember me forever for saying that. But when Furman did it and Kathleen Bell heard it, and these are people that don't, the guy's a stranger. You can't imagine someone coming up like nowadays after last week. I mean, a lot of people, you know, they won't surprise you anymore. But back then when someone comes up and says stuff like that to you, not knowing your value system or anything, you'll never forget that. You'll go, oh, my God, did you hear what this guy just said? You know, it's not, you'll go home, you'll lay awake at night. I don't care who you are. And he did that. And yet they wanted to trash Kathleen Bell. They wanted to trash all of our Furman witnesses as if they were making this up. And like I say, the tapes came so late in the game. I'm sitting here in my home looking at all these binders to Furman, and you know, because I had all this stuff out in my house to help Lee with this book, and it's, I go back through this again, I go, holy cow, this is just, you find new stuff every time I'm going in there, you know. And you just can go on and on about, holy cow, this poor guy, I wonder what was going through Simpson's head every day. And I know what his family were thinking because I was very tight with them. We'd, you know, meet at the homes afterwards and all that. And they were just distraught and happy that things are going on. But just to think about being locked up You're on top of the world. You're making more money than you ever made. You're loved by all of America. And all of a sudden, you're thrown in jail for 16, I think it was 16 and a half months that he was in jail for. And he had to be thinking, you know, not so much race, but it hit him when Furman took the fifth. And I remember watching him on TV, because he used to say, OJ, you know what? You're on TV 8 hours a day in a defendant's chair. You look like a defendant. There are people, by now, they're all saying the guy did it. And I thought he handled himself very well. And then I thought he was about ready to choke up when Furman got off the stand after taking the fifth, because it had to hit him like, you know what? If these guys wouldn't have found out this stuff, I'd be like just some kid in the public defender's office. I'd have been convicted, shipped off to prison, and spent the rest of my life saying I didn't do it. And that's what, you know, the criminal justice system, if you think about it, it's still to this day, courts, cops, police, jails, it's all controlled by white people. Okay. And the majority, and there's so many black people that are in jail that didn't do anything. And I, Lord knows, because I've defended a bunch of them, I still got cases like this, and you can almost prove it. But yet you're banging your head against the wall because, you know, they bar you for a time reason, or, you know, they don't care about the truth. They go, oh, you didn't meet this timeline, you know, so your motion's denied. And it's just so sad to well, you know, spend your whole life, not that my life hasn't been sad, but I mean, it's sad to see this your whole life. And when you try to talk to people about it, especially in my world, white people, they think I'm nuts, you know, until you have a chance to sit and talk. I now am the most popular guest at any sort of Christmas party or dinner party. Everybody says, oh, I want to sit next to McKenna next year, not just for OJ, but another other cases. And people just don't realize, because they're not in the court system. And so they see something on TV and it's just like, oh yeah, I can't even think of the names of various people. Oh, lock him up. Or, you know, this guy's guilty and all that stuff. And when it hits your own family, I mean, it's not gratifying, but when I'm sitting with somebody's family and they're saying my son's innocent and, you know, my son, how, he wouldn't do something like, you know, he let all these niggers off. We killed three people and they get 12 months. I've had these people say stuff. I mean, I've had people say that to me, right? But their son should get bail and should get this and that. I want to kind of not laugh in their face because they're in a very tough situation. So I try to have empathy, but it's kind of like, you know, you don't understand white privilege. You know, you think that. And I'm talking about people that have done some bad things, white people, you know, their families go, well, you know, why is my son getting this? Why does he have to take this plea 11 months? He didn't do, I mean, he didn't do anything. He hit the guy, so he broke the guy's job. I mean, and you hear it, and it's funny. It's not funny. I shouldn't use that word. But it's interesting that so many people over my career have said to me, sat there with family members and say, you know, my kid's a good kid. And you look at the crime and you go, well, he made a bad move. He's a good kid, but he's done a bad thing here. And we got some problems to get your kid, you know, out of this jam. And you always get the same thing, you know, or lawyers will say, oh, this guy here. I've had lawyers hire me, good lawyers, say, bring me in on a case over and over, and every time I'm introduced to the family, this one lawyer says, this is the only white guy in America thinks OJ, you know, he starts with, oh, he did OJ Simpson case, he names all the clients, you know, over the years, and he, by the way, he's the only white guy, it's like, it's funny, he's the only white guy thinks Simpson's innocent, and I want to say, but it's always the first interview and stuff, but I want to say, if I'm such a crackpot, what do you hire me over and over and over again for your wealthy white Johnnies and Julies that got a pound of methamphetamine that they flew in on a private jet from the Bahamas and they're wondering why they're looking at 10 to life in the federal system, you know? So it's just, I don't know how to describe it. You know, it's just kind of sad. And it's, you know, stuff I talk to my kids about. I go, you know, just, you know, because people say, hey, Megan, your dad's crazy. You know, my daughter had all that crap during high school when I was on this case. And just sad to see. And God only, I'm in a little tiny port in a dot in the ocean of the probably injustices in this country. And we're supposed to have the best system, you know? And anyway, I better get off this soapbox. But
let me nab one of our callers for you, Mr. McKenna.
Oh, okay, good.
Our caller in New Jersey. Did you have a question for Patrick J. McKenna, one of the investigators for the O.J. Simpson defense team? Did you have a question, sir?
Hey, how you doing? Hey, Gus. Call out of New Jersey. When I was looking at my when I remember the trial, I just remember seeing the Goldman family.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, is that the father with the very like thick mustache? That's the Goldman.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. You know, with all this evidence, you know, with all the information that you provided, and if he was in the if he was sitting in the courtroom all this time, you know, how how could the family? You know, I know you're grieving, you know, a loved one's death. But with all that damning information in favor of the defendant, Simpson, how could they still to this day come to the conclusion that he's guilty? And
well,
why
because,
were they so – I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. And why would
– No, go ahead.
I was going to say because their information came from the prosecution and the police, who convinced them. I mean, these, not everybody's a bad cop, right? So you want to tend to believe in the police and the people that are fighting on behalf of a victim and say, we got your guy. But as you sit, they sat in trial every day. They had to have questions about Furman, but you kind of, you still want to believe. And don't forget, they also had the, they were surrounded by media. They were kind of, and you know, it's aggravating to know because I know people that would just trigger certain things in Fred Goldman that would just get him off. You know, he would just, and they were just doing it. The media spent the entire time in this case shamelessly fawning at the feet of the prosecutors and the cops because we don't tell them anything. Yeah, we'd have press conferences and all that, but we wouldn't tell them what were our trials other than the man's innocent. You'll see in trial that he's going to be innocent. But like you say, the family, I felt bad for the family. I mean, I get calls, oh, they hate the Goldmans. It's like, I don't. I feel bad for them. I have empathy and sympathy for them. I just wish I could get to them someday without being on TV or in a podcast or all that and say, give me a question. I'll answer any question you have. Come to my home. Go look through every file I got. See if you can find some stuff that would incriminate Simpson more than what the media did. And let's go through any issue you have a question, any single issue in this case. And Lord knows, I have spent 26 years thinking about this, not 24/7, but all the time, because you go, God, if it could happen to a guy like this, you know, when it happens to a little guy in the courtroom that you see at the PD's office or something, you know, they got no money. And of course, the cops don't spend the money. They spent, if you knew the amount of money they spent, our taxpayers, for all these agencies to try to convict O.J. Simpson on stuff that we now know is junk science. For example, the hair and fiber stuff was crap. And just so much stuff. I'm getting away from your question about Mr. Goldman, but I understand why he's so angry, and it's because I think his mind is closed. Then they had the civil trial and, you know, they got a victory against OJ. I still think some of that was bad, badly presented by their side. You know, the shoe, all that stuff with those shoes, those pictures of the shoes, I think is complete hogwash, made up stuff. Cause if it was there, why didn't it come forward in a criminal case? Cause you know, Marcia Clark, anybody would love to have that. That would have been the most incriminating stuff of all. But, you know, the FBI did the most exhaustive shoe print, footprint exam in the history of the FBI. And nothing came back to Simpson. Then all of a sudden, the civil trial, we got these pictures by guys. You know, I could have put Prince Charles in those shoes if I had that kind of graphic skill. And so, and we weren't allowed to look at that or examine that or have time with that. So I understand why the Goldman family is so upset. And there's nothing I can do about it except offer the opportunity to sit with them and instead of in front of TV cameras, come to my home, or I'll bring all my stuff to your home and you ask me any question, I'll find it. I'll get in one of these boxes and pull out your question or refute your question with what is factual that shows Simpson didn't murder your son or his ex-wife, the mother of his children. So,
okay. I have one more question.
Sure.
Okay. So, you know, now that that case is in the past, what do you think is the greatest motivative factor for people not revisiting the case and saying we may have got it wrong? Do you think it's money? Because the OJ guilty industry has been very profitable, or racism? Which of the two is the stronger factor?
Well, it's both. In my opinion, number one, it's racism, because you could put together a hell of a documentary movie on his innocence, but they didn't. They went the other way. And then the ESPN did some 30-30, which I thought was kind of a lot of crap in there. And then they washed themselves with Emmys and Oscars and awards and all this stuff that in that field. When it basically, this was a street case. This should have taken 2 weeks to 2 months to try. And we were in court for 10 and a half months. Okay. And so they made this, I don't know how to describe it. It's the beginning of reality TV and the end of journalism as we knew it. Okay. And you look at it now and at least in my eyes, it's racism. You know, it's, if this was, like I say, Dan Marino, Joe Montana, Peyton Manning, any great white athlete, they'd be spending millions of dollars to show that the guy was framed by, let's say it was black cops that hated, you know, white guys that were ball players. You know what I mean? Just turn it around a little bit and you would see that how quickly they would have gone to the defense of all these folks. Especially if there's kind of questions about things and misbehavior by police officers that you trust to come in and tell the truth in front of a jury. But, you know, black defendant, too bad, you know, even if it's OJ. There's no money to it. It's 26 years later. Lee Bailey and I finally got a book. You think we got any money for this book? No. They gave Marsha Clark $4 or $5 million. Chris Darden got $1 million or $2 million. All the losers in this case got money. We're just, you know, and I ain't doing this for money. I'm just doing it because I think I know what I'm talking about 26 years later. And it really gets under the skin of white people when I claim it's racist. It's no different what they were doing to O.J. Simpson as a group than what that cop in Minnesota did to Mr. Floyd. I mean, they kneel, not only kneel on his neck, but glare into the camera and say, F you, you know, and that's kind of, I know this is crazy metaphors, but I see it in my work and in my life and all that stuff on a, you know, a daily or a weekly basis. And you know, I've got friends that slam their hand on the table. Mac, you always bring up race. What's wrong with it? You always got to bring up the racial part of it. And I go, well, if you don't see the racial part of this, that's because you enjoy a white privilege that you don't even understand, because you don't get pulled over. Your kid doesn't get pulled over because he's driving in your BMW because he's white. But a black kid driving a BMW, they got to pull him over because what's he do? And then it just goes from there to the next to the next. I mean, this whole crap that went on last week with all of these, whatever they are, Proud Boys, Proud Girls, whatever. You see, they're all talking about how horrible this country is and all that. So they're the same people that screamed at Colin Kaepernick, who basically peacefully knelt down to say, to call attention, say, listen, my brothers are getting shot and killed by white cops, and there's no recrimination for these cops. They get off. Their life was in fear. They thought the guy had a gun when he had a cell phone. And yet, these guys are showing up with guns and everything else and screaming and, you know, just think if, I think back when the militia out there, the Bundy or whatever that guy was in Utah or Oklahoma, wherever the hell it was, where those guys were holding off the Bureau of Land Management for, I don't know, days. I said, can you imagine if six black guys got automatic weapons and said, we're a militia? They'd have hosed them down. I mean, with machine gun fire. These guys, they get treated with hand kid gloves. Same thing with this Washington stuff. It's had me up for a week, you know, because I have lost some friends, lifelong friends, over that, because their go-to default position is, what about the Black Lives Matter? What when they were blowing up the Portland and Washington? I go, this is not, you're talking two different things here. And how many black protesters were shot with rubber bullets, were shot with real bullets, or beat up, or hosed down? And you look at these guys, cops are letting them in, and they're taking selfies and all that stuff. It's just, you know, and if I bring this up to my friends, you know, they want to have a fist fight. So I just, I have a new attitude that they don't exist in my universe anymore. And I just, including some family members, they just don't exist. I'm 73. I'm going to be 73 years old. I ain't got time for it anymore. Spent my whole life talking about this stuff and getting shouted down. And so I just go, if that's what you, if 2 and 2 is 9 in your world, have a nice day. I think 2 and 2 is 4. I calls them locks, I sees them, in the immortal words of some great umpire. And if it's upsetting, I'm sorry. But that's how I see it. And that's, I saw that, and it didn't dawn on me during Simpson. I'm thinking, hey, all my friends in the criminal defense bar around the country I've worked for, white lawyers, all, they got to be seen. We're kicking the government's ass in this case. And yet, all of those folks are saying to me, Mac, you know he's guilty. You know, God bless, you guys won. And I go, no, we didn't win. This was the innocent man. Forget the celebrity and all of that of Simpson. Think about his mom and his sisters and his kids, just like everybody thought about the Goldman's parents and his sisters and all that. Well, they got all the sympathy, but what about Simpson? Even if Simpson did do it, okay, that would reflect on his character, not on his family's feelings or character. And yet, you know, they were all just shot down. I mean, anybody that was friendly with Simpson was somewhat accused of helping him in a murder. Can you imagine if your best friend says, I just killed my wife, I need your help and get rid of evidence? You go, well, listen, I might help you. I'll help you get a lawyer, but I'm not going to dispose of it. I'm not going to be involved in a crime, you know, unless you're already a bad guy. But these were all professional people that that knew Simpson for 30 years or whatever. And they got accused, Kathy Wren and Kardashian, all these people got accused of helping them. AC, just God bless AC Collins, one of the greatest people I ever met in my life, but this guy got accused of everything and was offered money. He turned down millions of dollars from the tabloids to even talk to him. So this is my man. Here's what happened. You know, they knew that he was bringing him back to Los Angeles. This wasn't any guilty guy trying to escape. He went to the funeral. Or not the funeral, the cemetery, to pay his last respects before he was going to turn himself in. You know, we've talked about this a million times. The mistake was doing that. You should have first gone down and had a press conference in front of the police department, say, I'm turning myself in today. I didn't do this. These people will show you by the time. But, you know, it's easy to look back and say, could have, should have, would have, but certain things he did turned out to have everybody think, oh yeah, he's guilty. So I don't know if that answered your question about Mr. Goldman, but thanks for letting me rant again. But yeah, it's racism in my opinion. That's why you don't see anybody coming forward. Listen, we couldn't get a book publisher to help us. You know, for years we've been trying to do it. The same story. Well, this country isn't ready for an O.J. Simpson book. Bullshit. There's ready for if you said he did it, we'd sell 100 million copies. Just so people could say, see, I was right. When you say you've been wrong for 26 years, no one's going to, you know, who's going to read this? Maybe your younger listeners that only heard about this. Not my generation. My generation, you know, told their kids he's guilty. It's the kids that I talk to when I go to a college class or something like that. They get interested. They say, wow. But they've seen their whole life. They've been seeing this kind of racism and stuff. So you go, hey, way back when, look at this case from way back when, before you were born. Here's what happened in this country. So when you see what happened last week, it's not hard to imagine what happened in 1994. At least it shouldn't be hard to imagine. Anyways, I'll settle down here for a minute for your next question. Sorry about that.
Thanks a lot. I'm done. Thank you.
All right, man. Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Much obliged, our caller in New Jersey. I'll check, see if other folks have a question. I just wanted to ask because we've been reading and we covered Tubin's treatment of Faye Resnick and allegations that this crime might be connected to the drug world. And Tubin mm-hmm. kind of poo-poos all that. And, you know, that's ridiculous and absurd to say that this had some sort of connection to drug trafficking or Faye Resnick's drug use, or to say that some drug desperados came there and kind of mixed her up with Faye Resnick. And that's how this took place. Just from your research, any realistic yeah. drug angles to what happened here?
The only thing that I would say is, and being here in South Florida, I've done a lot of drug cases, trust me, since the 70s. And I've seen Columbia. If Nicole Brown owed a bunch of drug debt, the so-called dealers, the Columbia, the bad people, Mexican people, they would lean on O.J. Simpson to get their money. They don't go out to try to kill people. They want to get their money. They're on this for money. So the only thing drug related to me was Faye Resnick was in an in-house inpatient drug program the night of this murder. And could it have been, you know, there had been this, intervention with Faye and everybody to get her go in there because there was all kinds of drugs going on. OJ knew this. He said from day one, look, in Faye's world, you're going to find somebody in Faye's world that knows something. Of course, nobody in Faye's world would talk to us, but say, for example, they're all done, and now they're going to say, we are going to cooperate, you know? We're done with this. Just leave us alone, and we're going to tell the cops. Well, that could piss off a drug dealer, so maybe that angle might work. But I just don't, you know, this is, to me, no different than a million cold cases out there. Yeah, maybe drugs were involved, maybe something, but they don't know who did this. And so what happens when there's a murder tomorrow, for example, and what does the police say if they don't catch the guy in the act? We want to hear from anybody that saw anything, anybody heard anything. Please, here's our number. We'll keep your name quiet. We'll give you a reward. We need help. Well, they had all that in O.J. Simpson's case, and they ignored it. As a matter of fact, they attacked those folks and belittled them on the witness stand when they had all the help they wanted to have. So in terms of a drug angle, there could have been some angle like that, but this was, I don't know what this was, but it's a double murder. Don't know the motive. We don't know who did it. But what I do know after all these years, I know who didn't do it. And that's O.J. Simpson. And, you know, I don't know what else to say. You know, it's just, like I said, it's hard to argue with people. I don't argue with them anymore. I just go, give me your best shot, and I'll tell you what I can say to address that issue or this issue or whatever. But I don't know. I just know that two people were slaughtered, and there would have been a ton of blood evidence everywhere. And in 22 minutes, Simpson doesn't have the time, and he's really not a whatever, an expert in the dark arts, if you will, such as an assassin or a killer or something like that, that lives in that world. Simpson wasn't in that world. He doesn't have the wherewithal or the skill to pull something like that off. The average guy like you or me, except he had a great football career. But, you know, any one of your listeners tonight that's thinking about killing somebody could spend all night long thinking, I'll guarantee you, you're going to get caught or you're going to leave evidence or there's going to. So, you know, just this case was so, the more it goes on, the easier it is for me to say there's no way this guy did it. And there's a way that I believe Mark Furman planted the glove. And there's a reason why there's so-called evidence in the Bronco. I think he took the glove from Rockingham, stuck it in the Bronco. Then he brought him over to look at, quote, the little blood dot on the side of the door. He's made a mistake or two in his testimony when he talks about opening the door and looking in with his flashlight. He opened the door, and where the blood is, the so-called smear, is also telling because it's on the passenger, it's on the console between the passenger seat and the console. Mm-hmm. So it's much easier. Open the door, stick it there, okay? Close the door, and then later take it out of there and put it on the air conditioner. As it's more, it's insane to believe O.J. Simpson slaughtered these two people and has very little evidence except for this glove at his Rockingham home. So each little issue you could go for days on, and we tried to do that in this book. I mean, I tried to get every speck of testimony from the prelim, from the trial, from the civil trial, from police reports, for all of this stuff, and say to the reader, like, you know, go to the, for example, drugs. Start looking at the various drug angles and go to the various testimonies and all that sort of stuff. And Faye Resnick, she was in hiding from, quote, OJ's people to do this book because she was afraid they would find her and kill her. Her book was a load of crap. Okay, so, and guess what? She's still alive. So where are all these OJ people that wanted to kill her? I mean, she made herself some sort of victim. She's the one that'll go to the Goldman family and look them in the eye and say, oh, I don't know anything about this. You know, they'd laugh her out of the, well, they wouldn't laugh her out of the room. I'd laugh her out of the room.
Let's see, we had a person dialed in. M.A., did you have a question for Mr. McKenna? You should be with us. M.A., did you have a question?
Hello. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for taking my call. Greetings, everyone. This is my first time hearing Mr. McKenna, and I didn't hear at the very, very beginning, but I did want to know, as I'm listening to him speak, did you already ask him guys, with your definition of racism, white supremacy? Have you already answered that?
I did not. Well, I was so excited to get to the OJ information. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I use the word racism and the word white supremacy. I use them as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think that definition is accurate? Do you think such a system exists, Mr. McKenna?
Of course I do. Like I said earlier, if you look at the, in my world, the court system. So the court system, the police system, the trial system, the jail system, the prison system, it's basically controlled, if you will. I mean, there's black folks in positions, but the system itself is controlled by white people for years and years and years. And so, yeah, I guess I sound a little radical, but I'm just going on my own experience. You know, I'm the oldest of 10 kids. My dad never used that word. We grew up on the south side of Chicago in a blue collar family. We never heard that word. We never heard, anything of the sort. So maybe my experiences helped me not be, you know, I worked in steel mills. I went to Vietnam and, you know, you get in combat. You don't say, hey, send up ammo with a white guy, or, hey, send me a white medic. I'm wounded. Don't send me the black guy. Send me the, you know, so that in my world, I've never really, I've seen it, but I've never been part of it. I've been on the other side of it and watching it. And, like I say, I upset a whole lot of white people when I talk this way, but that's what I've seen. I've seen this system that I'm in as a very racist system. And, just on not every single case that comes through there, but when you take an overall look, you know, through the peephole down onto the system, there's far more people of color that have been abused, innocently locked up for years and years, taken from their family, shut down, don't have money for, you know, a team of lawyers like Simpson had. I mean, all Simpson was able to do was start to level the playing field. An everyday Joe, white or black, goes into the court system and you're up against the FBI, the DEA, whatever it might be, you don't have a chance, you know? You don't really have a chance, and you don't have the money, but at least in Simpson, you had enough resources to at least kind of level the playing field and bring in some people that have done this for a long time and have seen this sort of stuff, and we all fight the same battles every day. And but yeah, I agree with you. The system is completely racist, and if anybody doesn't believe it, you might want to look at the TV video from last week in the Capitol building and seeing these freaking people, these Duck Dynasty, well, not just the Duck Dynasty types, there were military people in there. And there's these kind of folks are, I remember saying that the FBI had done a report that they were concerned about white racist nationalists infiltrating the police department. It's like, oh, no kidding. Did you ever hear the name Mark Furman? We could start back 25 years ago. Now, 25 years later, it is infested with white supremacists. But they're, you know, they don't come into work every day wearing horns on their head and screaming all that, but they're insidiously all through the system, okay? And whether it's in the government or in the police or in government agencies or even sitting on the bench, it's there, whether, you know, and it's not going to go away. That's my fear, is it's going to be a long time to erase this. And will we ever? I don't know. But, you know, got to start somewhere, and we ought to start now and keep our knee on the necks of the white supremacist. But, you know, I'm just one little guy and running, speaking my opinions, but that's what I've seen. And, I'm not making this stuff up. I've just seen it with my own eyes, heard it with my own ears, smelled it with my own nose, and you know, teach my kids a different thing. I teach my kids the right way. I journal stuff now for when my grandkids are old enough to say, hey, Pops was a pretty interesting dude, wasn't he? He's against what all, you know, all that stuff. You know, I mean, I feel like I'm in a minority now, except when I'm talking to my friends and everybody's like appalled at what's going on the last 4 years and what's going on right now. So, you know, good luck to us as a nation. So, anyway, do you have any more folks that want? I couldn't really understand the woman. I need your help on that, Gus. I couldn't understand her question.
She wanted.
I couldn't hear it.
She did sound a little muffled, but she wanted your response to the definition, which you answered in the affirmative. Emmy, did you have another question for Mr. McKenna?
I'm sorry that you couldn't hear me that clearly. I have a map on. Anyway,
being safe.
Yeah, yes, so I do apologize. Hey, you know, I'm not one of those people. I will wear my mask.
Yeah, girl.
No, That was my question. And I didn't really have a follow-up one other than, actually, I did, just to clarify a little bit, because his definition, do you classify yourself as white, Mr. McKenna?
To classify myself what?
As white. Are you classified as white?
Yes, I'm a white
as
male.
As white, yeah. White.
Yeah.
Okay. Ask for clarification. I don't know what you look like, but also in his definition, I think encompasses all those who classify themselves as white as participating, upholding, and maintaining the system of racism, white supremacy. Would you agree?
Well, I agree that happens. I don't agree that I do that. I think I fight the system on a daily basis, even though my skin is white. I forget what Johnny used to call me. I was a black man. Oh, he used to call me, I was a black man trapped in a white body. And we would do that jokingly, you know. But just because I speak out about it. I mean, we used to be somewhat of a celebrity, right? The investigators. So there was three of us. That used to leave when we were at Shapiro's office, leave his office about 8 o'clock every night, go get dinner across the street at ABC, whatever it is over there. And there was me, another investigator, white guy, and then our IT guy, Howard Harris, my friend, he was just here at my house earlier, the black guy that did all of our, remember the Elmo and all that in court, I always give him grief. He looked like Peebo Bryson, but he's the guy that does the Elmo in the trial. We call him the quiet man, but I remember saying one time, we'd go to this restaurant every night, walk in, and I forget the fella's name, the maitre d', he was a Persian fella. And he would always say, hey, Pat, or hey, John, hi, Howdy, shake all of our hands. Never once in 3 or 4 months did he shake Howard's hand first. He always shook me first, or John, and then Howard. Or me, John first, me second, and then Howard. But it was always, hi, I'm bringing that up one time. I said, did you ever notice how, God, what was his name? I forget his name. But I said, did you ever notice, Howard, how, and I was saying this in front of John, how he always shakes your hand third, the black guy. And John gets pissed off at me and says, what do you even talk like that for? And Howard, who I knew before OJ, and now we're still best friends, he always said, you know, you pick up on stuff like this. I picked it up, but very few white people that I've known would pick that up like you do. I said, well, I know how to read a room, you know. That's one of my skills in my work is reading a room when I walk in. And it's just something I always noticed. And so even though my skin is white, I feel like I'm certain I'm not a racist. At least I feel that. And I hope I live my life that way. Hope I teach my kids that way. So that's all I can really say. I'm a white guy and classified as a white male. And that's who I am. But I try to live my life as a person that accepts anyone, race, color, creed, religion, gender, disabled. If you're disabled, I don't make fun of disabled people. That's the way my parents raised me, period, end of story. I mean, I think all of this stuff here that's going on, this racist stuff, the scary part is at home where these people are from, their children are being taught this stuff. Okay, that's why I don't think it's going to just go away. All these idiots that were out there with their, Chewbacca bikinis and horns and all of this ridiculous stuff. And talk about making disrespecting the flag. They want to whine about Colin Kaepernick. These people waving flags and Confederate flags. I mean, to see a Confederate flag in the Capitol is at this day and age. And they listen to these people whine about taking down statues of Confederate soldiers and renaming Air Force bases, Army bases, whatever. To see the backlash when people suggest, I mean, to me, it's like, get rid of that stuff. And yet, these people want to hang on to that. You know, the racists want to hang on to this stuff. And it's just like I say, it's a sad thing because those people are training their children, if they have any, to be the same way. And their wives and girlfriends, whatever was out there, 1,000 people, there's 50,000 of them right behind those people that think the same way they do. And it's a scary thought. So, anyways, there you have it.
Did that answer your question, Emmy?
It did. And then I have one follow-up. May I, then?
Yes, ma'am.
Sure.
As a man who is classified as a white, actually, I guess a two-parter, and then I will mute myself after this. Do you think that people who are classified as white are greatly pained by the system of racism, white supremacy? And then how do you think, or what do you think will bring about, as a white man or a man classified as white, will bring about the end of the system of racism, white supremacy? Thank you for answering my questions, and thank you guys for taking my call.
Sure, Gus, you need to help me because it was muffled and I didn't get the question really well.
I put my thinking cap on so that I could listen closely. So her two-part question, she says, okay. Part one, she says, do you think white people are sincerely pained about racism? That was one. And then the second part is, what do you think, as a white man, what do you think it will take to bring about the end of the system of white supremacy?
Okay. So the first part, geez, I already forgot the first part. As a white person.
Sincerely pained.
Sincerely pained. People like me, people that I associate with in the public defender's office and other places, white people that identify as white, there is a lot of us that are pained by it. But we're a minority, I think. It's scary to say, but I think I'm a minority in my generation. Because when you bring it up, I get the same kind of, like I say, the default position is, well, what about Black Lives Matter? And what about this and what about that? I mean, to me, that's just as racist as, that's more racist than listening to what I just said to you, you know, to the person. And so in terms of pain, I don't think the majority of people are pained. I think they will sit in their white privilege and go, well, they can't. I mean, there was no black people last week. The only black people I saw in the Capitol were the poor cops that were trying to keep these racists out of there. Okay. But when they see the Black Lives Matter protest, which turns into whatever, looting or something like that, we want to shoot these people, shoot journalists in the face with bullets, rubber bullets and all that. You didn't see any of that last week. So the pain, I don't think there is pain in the, quote, the white race like there should be. There is pain in certain white people, but in terms of the whole race, I don't know if they have the same pain that I feel when I see this. I mean, it's painful enough for me to lose a relative, a blood relative, just say, you're done. You don't exist. Goodbye. Don't even call. Don't, you know, that's someone in my own blood. And then the second part about what would it take? I have no clue other than do the best I can. And the people that I know do the best with our children and try to raise them up right. And, it's sad to say, but I don't know how to get rid of the racism. The only way I see it happening is, frankly, is because the numbers are going to change. We're going to be a minority down the road. At least I see that in Florida, where the brown people, the Cuban Americans, the Guatemala, all the immigrants that come, the Guatemalans and the other people of color, they're far more, there's going to be far more of them than there is the white folks. So, you know, maybe that'll have an impact on it. I don't know. I just don't have an answer of how we stop the white racist system that we're in. Like I say, we have black people in positions in the system, but they're not in control of it. They need to be in control of the system, you know? You know, I hear about the guy that one of the guys they arrested. He's whining. He's not eating because he wants to be a vegan or not vegan, but organic food. It's like, that's your white privilege. Because I know people that eat peanut butter or, you know, bad bologna and the shit that they serve you in prisons and jails around this country. If they had they don't even think to say, hey, I'd like some organic food here. I'm not going to eat this. They eat, you eat it and suffer with it. So the only way it goes away, I don't know how it goes away. I'm just at a loss, Gus. I don't know what to say. You know, I didn't go to the finest schools or read all the classics. I'm kind of a street guy from Chicago, and I grew up loving my brothers and sisters, you know, of any color. And I just wish that everybody, you know, lived that life, you know?
Wow.
So.
Emmy got both of her questions answered, I believe. Much obliged, Emmy. Wow, I did not get a chance to hear about that. The demands for I'm not going to eat this. I will need Whole Foods organic meal while I'm in prison for my treasonous conduct in the nation's capital.
Yeah, the guy wearing the horns. His mother is saying he's on a hunger strike. And I guess the federal judge. What's funny is I heard that they're going to give him that kind of food, you know, organic food. I'm thinking, give me a break. How does that happen? I have sat with inmates for 40 years watching what they're being fed and going, oh, man. And I'm watching them wolf it down because that's all they get to eat all day long. And, you know, and these guys, I had a bunch of cases one time, big drug case, all white guys, and they wanted to have sent in at their own expense fresh fruit. You don't get fresh fruit in jail or prison. You get this crap that's, you know, I don't know where it comes from, but you sure don't get. And they were offering to pay, and that, you know, Fed say, nope, eat what we serve you. And so, you know, this guy's wanting organic food. And somebody had a funny thing, said instead of Trader Joe's, it was Traitor with a T. Your food, you might need to go to shop at Trader Joe's. You know?
I'm stunned. Well, I guess maybe I shouldn't be surprised. I do remember Dylan Storm Roof. He did get to stop and get a Whopper after having killed nine people at Charleston's Mother Emanuel Church. So I guess that is another component of white supremacy racism, that you can commit all sorts of crimes and still get caviar and, you know, vegan meals, quinoa.
And I think they put him in a freaking, I think, a flag jacket in case somebody took a pop at him. He did anything to protect them.
Mm.
And then you got some guy kneeling in some guy's back or shooting a guy seven times in the back and with no charges because he felt like he was in fear of his life. I don't know about you. I fought in Vietnam. I could shoot you in the back. I don't need to shoot you seven times if I'm, you know, and then walk away from it. But and that's what I mean about the system. The system is so controlled. Say what you want, but this poor, it's on video, for God's sakes. You know, the guy's going into his car, and in front of his children, he gets shot seven times in the back. And there's no charges against the cop. And you know, if people were outraged and wanted to do a demonstration, they'd be met with SWAT teams and hoses and water cannons and everything else.
Drones.
They suck it up. You know? Yeah, drones, everything. So it's just, God, it's a scary thought. You know, that woman just shattered me when she said, what can we do to stop it? I don't know. I think it's going to grow exponentially, sad to say, until all these white, if these guys are, you know, I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take. But it's a sad day for America.
More to
started with OJ.
He says that certainly is a huge part in it. My goodness. Like, we had Steven Singular on the program who wrote the book Legacy of Deception.
Know.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Steven. I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
And
when he's a good man.
I enjoyed his book. I learned quite a bit, but he said this, we had him on the day of the melee in D.C. And we were talking about domestic terrorism because he mentions he links Mark Furman with Timothy McVeigh in his book with the Oklahoma City bombing. And that happened in 95, the same time as the trial, and saying, oh, wow, Mark Furman moved to Idaho. Timothy McVeigh was hanging out in Idaho. Maybe they know each other. They have the same type of views. Like the turn times, like, wow. And I'd never thought of connecting the two. And he said, he used the term domestic terrorist. He said, Timothy McVeigh is one component of domestic terrorism. And he said, Mark Furman is another component of domestic terrorism. Yeah. And I had never thought of, wow, Mark Furman is a domestic terrorist. And it was last Wednesday, the day of everything going to that is white supremacy. Racism is the domestic terrorism. And Mark Furman would be a great point to illustrate and allowing that to fester for 25 years. And here we are.
What do you think Mark Furman has told his wife and children about race in the last 25 years? I shudder to think what kind of children grew up, because I couldn't think for 2 seconds of trying to teach that to my children. But I'll guarantee you, and he wasn't the only guy in the LAPD, okay? I mean, we can go for hours on that, too. Mark Furman was part of a whole group of people. As a matter of fact, way after this case, there was a federal judge that called the LAPD a racketeering enterprise for what they were doing to people of color. They were beating them up in the basements and setting them up and planting guns and evidence on people because, quote, they're gang members or they're people that, you know, you don't even want to examine anything about them or their life or anything. They just want to set them up and lock them up.
The Rampart scandal, I've said that repeatedly in reading all this, that people should, it shouldn't just be Rodney King, it should be the Rampart scandal, like exactly what you just said. Mark Furman is not an anomaly, like this is the entire decade LAPD behavior and accusations of this sort of behavior, beating up black people, planting evidence on black people, doing as a systemic manner of practice, beating up and planting evidence, false accusations, like every single component of the O.J. Simpson, racial slurs, all of it right there for a whole decade, way beyond. And even just the way that he was defended, I pointed that out. It's not like it was, oh, man. Yeah. This guy's hard. It was like, no, this is our guy. He didn't do this. Like, it took those tapes coming out before it became, oh, wow, like this guy's awful. And, oh, yeah, we're not going to support. I mean, lots to study. Mark Furman. And again, the way he's been sanitized, that, again, is systemic. Oh. That's not just one person. That is group activity to protect and restore honor and all that to Mark Furman. So he's not such a bad guy that... But
they managed to bring him on the Oprah show, and he kind of had him with kid gloves. I mean, it was just insane. It's not only insane, it's disgusting that all you got to do is listen to these. I'll guarantee you, Oprah Winfrey never sat and listened to these. I don't know how many hours we have of it, because it makes you sick to your stomach, whether you're white, black, brown, whatever, to hear this guy. And then, speaking of sanitizing, he was making up, he was role-playing for a movie. What movie do you role-play when you talk about, I'm the detective in the biggest case in the country? Without the glove, the case goes bye-bye. Bragging about it. This is how arrogant he was. Even after we got a spotlight on this guy, he's bragging to Laura Hart McKinney that he's the detective. He's got the glove. It's just phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It's the same as the look in that cop's Minnesota cop where he's glaring at the camera like, yeah, I'm doing this. Do something about it. kneeling on a poor guy for 9 minutes, 8 minutes, whatever it was, Mr. Floyd. And that's what Furman does. He just glared at everybody. He said, "You can't get me. I'm doing it. I'll do it again, and I'll keep doing it again. And you won't stop me." So, hey.
That's our guest, Patrick J. McKenna. It has been a hoot having you on the program. I'm going to definitely be looking forward to you and F. Lee Bailey's book coming out later this year to get more information about the case. And we can add that to our library of O.J. Simpson literature. But, man, it has been grand to have you on the program with us this evening. I've been checking out some of Mr. Heiss's work. So, yeah, I'll try and do some digging to see if maybe we can talk to him and encourage folks to do some researching as well, because he has great work on the timeline and such, too. So,
he's done a phenomenal job. Yep. So,
thank you so much for sharing time with us.
My pleasure.
Definitely appreciate learning from you, Mr. McKenna. And as I said, we'll be looking out for the book, and hopefully we'll get a chance to reach out and touch with you again.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, and enjoy the rest of your evening, sir. We'll talk soon.
All right. Real good. Real good.
Bye-bye. Evening. Good evening. The Cows Context of White Supremacy. That was Patrick J. McKenna, one of the investigators for the O.J. Simpson defense team. We've been doing our O.J. Simpson, right? And in short order, we have got a pretty like nifty little catalog of programs. We had Stephen Singular, as I just said, last week he was with us. We had F. Lee Bailey a few weeks back. Mr. McKenna today, we're doing the book club. Jeffrey Toobin, we've got about halfway through the book, so I mean, quite a bit of material already, and we still got the other half of the book to go. Work to see if we can get some other folks on the program as well to talk about the case. I cannot say enough, like, man, I totally thought O.J. Simpson was guilty. In fact, when he talk about metaphors all the time, when he used the metaphor Mark Furman and what they were doing to O.J. Simpson is the exact same thing as the white officers in Minnesota having their knee on George Floyd's neck. Oh my goodness. Before, I think I would have been like, "You're joking. Get out of here. That is not the same thing at all to even compare the two. Like, O.J. Simpson killed those white people, number one, and blah, blah, blah." I mean, I would have rejected that sort of thing totally in saying, you know, that was an act of police terrorism and the way that the police treated O.J. I wouldn't have signed off on that at all. He was totally guilty, and what a misrepresentation, and you're disparaging the memory of George Floyd to compare him to O.J. Simpson, and confusion is lethal. It has been. I hope people, you know, that listen to the Cows, like, we're in the midst of a global health pandemic. The terrorism in the nation's capital, potential impeachment of the current president, all of these things that are happening, people losing their job and having to make decisions about getting a vaccine, all of these things that are happening in the world. Why on earth is this the moment that the Cows and Gus T would say, "Yes, let's talk about O.J. Simpson"? I hope that it makes some sort of logical sense, that people are able to learn something constructive. And I mean, even our guest this evening making direct connections to things that are happening right now with the O.J. Simpson case. 2 weeks in a row, in fact, direct connections with what is happening right now and the O.J. Simpson case. I would have laughed at all of that not that long ago, just not being informed about the case, reading more important than watching television. Can't say it enough. The book club is on Thursday. We are starting the trial this week in the book club. So if you followed the trial, if you didn't follow the trial, if you, you know, whatever your position is on whether or not O.J. Simpson is guilty, would probably be
an informative experience to study how Jeffrey Toobin writes about the trial. And then we're trying to add other information as we go to from other sources and things of that nature. So at least for me, it's been extremely constructive and very humbling just to see like, wow, like I believed all of this, like what you heard from Mr. McKenna this evening. Like, I believe, like, yeah, O.J. Simpson killed these white people and flew across town and disposed of all the goodies and just has been fooling us for a quarter century. Like, yes, I believed all of that. Didn't even watch the trial to have any information, just, you know, believed it by osmosis. I guess, if anything, a reminder of how easily in this system we can be convinced of black guilt. No proof, no evidence. A lot of times you don't even have to do any investigating. We got you. This nigga did it. Don't even worry about it. He did. We know he did it. we'll go about connecting the dots later, but just trust us. This nigga did it. These niggers did it. Sometimes it'll be Central Park 5, but either way, nigger, they did it. They're guilty. Incidentally, for this program, I was so on my, how shall I say, O.J. Simpson grind, right? I was ready to dig in and let's make sure we can cover as much as we can with Mr. McKenna and blah, 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 that I didn't even, you know, do our normal counter-racist setup. Like, hey, are you classified as white? Definition for racism. You know, our normal questions when we have a white person on, and we had Emmy come in and host properly. Like, wait a minute, what definition did you get that? Did you agree with the definition of racism? Let's make sure we do things properly. Are you a white person? Like, to make sure we cover our bases before we go out. Like, much obliged to Emmy for making sure we did not shirk our hosting responsibilities, because that is so important. Just definitions. What do we say? What do we mean? What definition are we applying to the term racism or white supremacy? Because so many people throw those terms around, and or white privilege, did hear that a lot this evening. We'll throw that term around without having a definition. And that's where we start to get clarity, understanding, having a definition. The grandsister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, also a Chicago native. She used to talk about that all the time, making sure we have a definition. So much obliged, Emmy. And she was doing double duty at work and then still able to call it and make sure we got the definition in and clearing up that, yes, we are talking to a white man. Let's see. Our caller, I guess, in the Los Angeles area, hand up. Did you have a question, commentary, thoughts on what you heard from Mr. McKenna? Just getting loud background. I don't know if you're in a vehicle or maybe that was the television, or I'm not sure. Maybe you're on speakerphone, but it's kind of piercing my ears. So I'll give you a second to see if you have your background noise situated. If you need to kind of relocate, get to a quieter area, maybe that'll work. We'll be here tomorrow, incidentally. Miriam Carey, we talked about, speaking of the madness at the Capitol, we had the author of the book, The N-Word is No Secret in the, what is it? The N-Word is No Secret in the Secret Service. That's it. He was a guest on the program in 2019. 2019, guest on the program, black male, former member of the Secret Service. And we talked about lots of workplace racism. He talked about working with other non-white people and how being confused, confusion is lethal. They would be confused, and a lot of anti-blackness. Fascinating dialogue. Racist white people, like we talked about so much in his book. He has a whole, like, pretty massive section on Miriam Carey and working in the Secret Service when the shooting happened, and just talking about the details and what a massive act of racism this was, that if Miriam Carey was white, there is no way she would have been murdered. And it was such a big failure that we didn't get to invest more time talking about this when he was on the program before. And I was like, man, that is messed up. Like, we had talked about Miriam Carey, and so many of our listeners know about her 2013 murder, or should know about her 2013 murder. And with what happened at the Capitol last week, I know myself and many other folks immediately, they didn't have lax security and breaches in security in 2013. They had live fatal response and then got applause for killing an unarmed black female with her child in the vehicle afterwards. That's what happened then. So we're making up for that tomorrow. We will have the author back with us on the program, and we'll be devoting the entire program to his experience. He went and spoke with her attorney, Eric Sanders. The attorney for the family for Ms. Sanders, Eric Sanders, who's a black male who's done a number of interviews. He was on Democracy Now! And did reports talking about the case. I've reached out to him. He's been, I thought, very generous with his time in talking about this case and trying to make sure that people understand this is an act of police terrorism, white supremacy. But we'll be going over that case and putting it in context of what happened last week in terms of security protocols, what is supposed to happen, just the sheer volume of enforcement officials in D.C. for what was allowed to happen last week, as opposed to the way that they responded to Miriam Carey. But that'll be the broadcast tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. We'll be here every day for the next week. All right, we'll try again. Our caller in the L.A. area, let's see if it's audible. We can talk about it.
Yeah. Sorry about that, guys.
Yes,
this is 0526. Hello, guys. Hello, Colin. Thanks for the show tonight. My question for you, Gus, is there any particular reason on Black Talk Radio the context of white supremacy is not on, like, the clickables anymore, like where it has all their content is just no longer there for some reason when I was looking for it earlier? Is there any...
Our subscription expired. It's renewed now, but it expired over the weekend, or I guess at the beginning. Well, either or, beginning of the year, end of the weekend. But it's renewed now, so that's probably why it expired briefly. But I reckon it'll be there either today, tomorrow, whatever time I renewed it. I think this morning sometime. So I guess it should be back. I don't know, sometime this week or so. Just check back to see when it's there. In the meantime, you can double check SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts. I posted a number of the other different platforms where all of the archives are available for any of the programs that had, like, the broadcast for today and the compensatory call-in, just in case they're not posted there, where you can download or stream or what have you, can access all of the content. But I think that should be the problem, and it should be remedied, I reckon, within about 24 hours or so, I would think. Just keep checking back, I guess.
Thanks. Yeah, I just thought maybe you maybe quit or something, but I'm glad that's not the case. Thank you.
For sure. Didn't give up the counter racist grind quite yet. It has certainly been unpleasant, but yes, did not storm off the air today. Should be back tomorrow, I reckon. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Miriam Carey, or not Miriam Carey, but talking about her 2013 murder. Looking forward to making up for just an omission. Now, I can't really say omission because I was, you know, looking forward to talking about all of that. I think it's important, that case and all, but we had so much material. Almost like today, it was a lot of material to cover. So sometimes 3 hours is not quite enough to cover everything. Should have made that a greater priority back then, but thankfully we will have time to make amends tomorrow, Wednesday, January 2013. We'll be ready to roll. Any other folks have comments they needed to make sure they shared, got in? Grand. Cool, everybody. Satisfied for today. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. And hopefully the O.J. Simpson content is worthy of folks' time and energy. And we're not, you know, wasting time in the midst of all of these really serious problems, things that are happening in the known universe, U.S. specifically, to be talking about a case from 25 years ago. Like, man, we could be talking about substantially more pertinent things or whatever the case, but hopefully this is constructive, relevant information on what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white. If not, I guess folks can let us know that too. Like, you've been vested way too much time talking about Arundel James, and, you know, find something more constructive or relevant to talk about. Let's see. Make sure I didn't miss. Victim of racism that dialed in. Victim of racism. Question, comment before we are all done.
Hi, Gus and Kyle's listeners. I just wanted to say that just the way how they treated Mark Furman, it seemed like they used him as a racial, as a white sacrifice. And Mr. Fuller has that term that, you know, sometimes when white supremacists, well, suspected white supremacists, have conflicts between each other, they sometimes will use each other to make the system stronger. So I just wondered what anybody thought of that. If you have a comment on that, sir, thank you.
I think certainly white people at times, they will sacrifice or make someone classified as white expendable. Within the system, that certainly does happen. Sometimes it might be with like a Donald Trump, Donald Sterling, a white person who gets accused of practicing racism. And maybe there's a lot of evidence, like it's not just, you know, a verbal accusation. It'll be video and corroborating proof. Maybe you have some other white people like, oh, yeah, this white person definitely practiced racism, where they'll just say, you know, we can just isolate and we'll say that this white person, yes, is unfortunately racist, and or this white person did do some bad things and we might have to punish them. And yeah, we can't have white people doing this sort of thing. This is just terrible. Although this isn't all of us, you know, this is an anomaly. But yes, this is a bad white person. They will do that sort of thing if you get like it, like with this, where you get, I think he said, Mr. McKenna, like 20, 40 hours of content, these audio recordings of Mark Furman talking to Laura Hart McKinney and nigger this. And as he was saying, you know, F all the niggers and, you know, bomb them and burn them up and kill them. And, you know, if I see a black guy and he's got a white woman and, you know, I stop him and I make up a reason, you know, that type. You get caught and you've got hours and hours and hours of that. Like, oh, yeah, we might have to sacrifice old Mark. But even there, whew, that's almost like, you know, if you watch long enough, it almost transitioned from that to white people don't get fired. They get transferred, because Mr. Furman, they did for a time say, oh, man, we got a he's a racist. Even Marsha Clark, one of the prosecutors in the case, at the closing arguments, she says, is Mark Furman a racist? Yes. Is Mark Furman the worst the LAPD has to offer? Yes. Do we wish he had never been hired as a police officer? Yes. Do we wish he had never been born? Yes. I mean, this is in the closing arguments. This is, you know, millions of people watching live on television. So, I mean, like, that's massive white sacrifice. Who says that about a white person ever? Like, you could lynch a black person and they're not going to say you're a racist and we wish you. They don't even say that about Hitler. But like I said, you wait long enough, and he talked about Dominic Dune and we'll get you a book deal and all this. Now he gets to go out on that. He has a better reputation than O.J. Simpson. Like, now, you know, hey, they just used it. He's a victim. You know, he comes out and talks like, oh, they tarred and feathered me. And, oh, they just tarnished and played the race card. And, oh, woe is me, victim. That's basically what he says. I was a sacrifice. I was a white sacrifice. They just had to call somebody a racist and blame everything on me. And
woe is me, poor Mark Furman. But he gets to write books and make millions of dollars. He gets to go on Oprah Winfrey and all these different talk shows and documentaries and make lots of money. Like, he has a much better reputation than O.J. Simpson. Fox, they have him. I think he was like a... He had like a title. He had like a position. It wasn't like he was just, you know, guest will come and holler at you every other week. He had like a position, you know, like he was a regular. He was on, you know, in installments and such. So absolutely white sacrifice, although it almost transitioned to he just got transferred, you know. Any other thoughts folks had? We'll have much more to chat about with Mark Furman and all that as we get through the book club. We have, let's just say, we're just getting to the trial in the book club. So we haven't even got to, we'll be able to like process, see how Tubin writes about all of this, like when Furman first testifies and then once the tapes come out and all that. So we'll see how all that unfolds in the book, or at least how Tubin writes about all of this in the book. But yes, we can keep that in mind. Is he being treated like a sacrifice? Is he just going to be the one racist scapegoat who gets blamed for why O.J. Simpson got off? We'll keep that in mind. And what I'd said, I told people, Laura Hart McKinney, he said she felt guilty about all of this. Like, man, that no good O.J. Simpson did it. He killed those white people and it's my fault. It's these audio tapes that let that no count O.J. Get off of killing those white people. I said that like tons of these witnesses who had exculpatory information that would tend to suggest maybe O.J. didn't do it, they thought he was guilty. And what I said, I don't think it was Laura Hart McKinney, like, oh, I want to do the right thing and, you know, I want to come and share this information because Mark Furman is a racist. Like, no, it does not sound like that's the way it went. And no, it didn't sound that way at all. If she felt guilty about all this, it should be, yeah, I am proud to come and step forward and expose a psychopathic race soldier. But I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that at all. It was, man, let that no count OJ off. We'll pay attention to that in Tubin's book as well. Anywho, we will be here tomorrow. Much obliged for folks tuning in. Miriam Carey. If you don't know who Miriam Carey is, you should definitely tune in tomorrow. If you are familiar, Grant, make sure you share and, you know, make sure your folks that you care about, offspring, other family members, are informed about Miriam Carey. And we will be ready for tomorrow to compare and contrast what happened in the Capitol to the performance in 2013, where I believe some of the very same members of Congress who were hunkered down and talking, we're petrified, we're going to die. Oh my God, what's going on? Some of those very same members of Congress from last week were the folks who sat there and applauded and hooted and celebrated the murder of Miriam Carey as excellent police work, keeping them safe and secure. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We need our brain computer working completely. They said O.J. Simpson sober. They got his blood right because that was part of the accusation. Like, he was hyped up on all kinds of drugs and things. So he had superhuman strength to go out and kill these people. Sobriety would be best. In addition to be sober, I would say hunker down. It's been crazy. The reports I saw today, they were expecting additional violence leading up to the inauguration next week. So be mindful of that. If you have to go out, be very vigilant about your surroundings. If you see white people that are being loud, really anybody, but particularly white people who are being loud, rowdy about anything, be very alert. You're not engaging, no, you know, verbal confrontations with folks under these conditions. You should be thinking, really, if they're out being loud and rowdy, this person might be armed. They might be with a whole group of folks who are armed. Like, I did not leave my residence thinking, oh, yeah, I'm going to engage in some sort of mortal combat. That being the case, you are all, or we should be all, about minimizing risk and danger in lots of ways. Masks, staying home, avoiding confrontations, white people and or non-white people. If you got to go out, be very vigilant, very sober. You are buckled up. And if you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, we need all of our attention so we can be very mindful about what's happening around us. And we want to do just the little things that we can to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe. Small things, being sober, being buckled, not on the cell phone, just the little thing that we can, little things that we can do to try to keep ourselves safe. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.